really big questions with humpbacks is, why do they sing?
Join me, Hannah Fry, on 10 extraordinary adventures of data and discovery on BBC Sounds and Radio 4 next Monday to Friday afternoon at 1:45. It's 6 o'clock on Tuesday, the 3rd of September. Good morning. This is Today with Nick Robinson and Michelle Hussein.
The headlines this morning: the chief rabbi has condemned the British government for suspending some arms sales to Israel, saying it beggars belief. The defence secretary will join us at 8:10 to defend the decision. Scotland's finance minister is set to announce hundreds of millions of pounds in spending cuts for this financial year.
Also in today's programme, the head of Ofsted will join us after an independent report says the organisation was defensive and complacent after the suicide of head teacher Ruth Perry. After the Birmingham library he used as a child is slated for closure, Lee Child, the creator of Jack Reacher, tells us what it gave him.
I'm so sentimental about it and so emotional about it because that building saved my life at the time. It enabled it. It largely created it. I just read and read and read.
And after another stellar day at the Paralympics, Rose Ayling-Ellis, who is part of Channel 4's coverage from Paris, tells us about the thrill of seeing Great Britain so high in the medals table. The BBC News is read by Caroline Nichols.
The UK's chief rabbi, Sir Ephraim Mervis, has said it beggars belief that the British government has blocked some arms sales to Israel. The Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, told MPs yesterday that the UK was suspending around 30 of the existing 350 export licences where there was a clear risk the items might be used to violate international humanitarian law. Sir Ephraim warned the action fed the falsehood there had been violations by Israel. Our political correspondent Harry Farley reports.
The government's announcement is more significant politically than militarily. UK arms exports are relatively small, less than 1% of Israel's total weapons imports. But it matters both diplomatically and domestically on a sensitive issue for the Labour Party. The chief rabbi, Sir Ephraim Mervis, who criticised Labour under Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, said the announcement would serve to encourage Israel and the UK's shared enemies. He added the timing, coming as funerals were held for some of the hostages found dead on Saturday, beggared belief. A spokesman for the government said it was legally obliged to suspend export licences for arms that could be used in the current conflict, but the UK remained committed to Israel's security.
Scotland's finance secretary, Shona Robison, is expected to confirm today that she's making hundreds of millions of pounds in cuts to public services this financial year. The Scottish government says its budget has been reduced by Westminster. The UK government has blamed incompetence by both the SNP and the previous Conservative administration in London. Here's our Scotland editor, James Cook.
Shona Robison says the UK is entering a new era of austerity, which will have a profound effect on the Scottish government's ability to deliver services. The widespread cuts she will announce at Holyrood later come on top of measures already taken to reduce spending, including means-testing winter fuel payments, closing a fund for the arts, and ending some subsidised rail fares. The independent Scottish Fiscal Commission says much of the pressure on the budget comes from the SNP's own decisions, including freezing council tax and raising public sector pay. But the Scottish Government says the root problem is that the UK is plagued by entrenched poverty and low growth, exacerbated by its departure from the European Union.
BBC News has seen a letter from the Cabinet Secretary Simon Case that suggests some actions taken by the previous government contributed to uncertainty over public spending. Mr Case was replying to the former Chancellor Jeremy Hunt, who had said Labour's claims to have inherited an economic black hole had brought the civil service into disrepute. Our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman, has seen the letter.
When Rachel Reeves unveiled what she said was a shocking £22 billion spending gap in July, her predecessor as Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, was furious, not only attacking his political rival, but questioning why her figures differed from those signed off by civil servants just days before. In his private response to Mr Hunt, leaked to the BBC, Simon Case, the Cabinet Secretary, said this mismatch was simply an inevitable result of the parliamentary timetable being warped by the sudden general election, and that the civil service had acted appropriately throughout. But then he went further, contending that sizeable in-year changes to spending plans in recent years were because of the last Conservative government's decision not to hold a new spending review, which would have updated departmental budgets at any point since 2021. An ally of Mr Hunt said they were unsurprised that the head of the civil service was supporting the current government's position. A spokesperson for the Cabinet Office said it did not comment on leaks.
An independent review suggests England's schools inspector at Ofsted was defensive and complacent in its response to the suicide of the head teacher Ruth Perry. She killed herself in January 2023 while waiting for the publication of a report that would downgrade her school to inadequate. Ofsted's chief inspector has accepted most of the review's recommendations, which include better mental health training and support for inspectors. The Home Office is to hold a meeting with technology companies and manufacturers to examine ways to reduce thefts of mobile phones. They'll consider how to make it easier and quicker to disable a device permanently, so stolen phones are harder to sell. The Crime Survey for England and Wales estimates 78,000 people in the past year had phones or bags snatched from them on the street. A survey suggests there's been a sharp fall in national pride over the past decade. According to the National Centre for Social Research, the proportion of people saying they're proud of Britain's history has dropped from 86% to 64%. But there are indications Britain has become more inclusive in its attitudes, as our Home Editor Mark Easton reports.
A decade ago, amid intense debates about Brexit and immigration, the survey reported almost two-thirds of people saying they'd rather be a citizen of Britain than anywhere else. Now, only half agree with that statement. Pride in Britain's history has fallen dramatically amid arguments over the empire and slavery. What emerges is a country increasingly proud of its cultural diversity, of its sporting and artistic achievements, but also challenging ideas of superiority or exceptionalism.
Mark Easton reporting.
Thank you very much indeed, Caroline. 6 minutes past six. Time for the weather now. Let's go over to Darren Bett. Morning, Darren.
Good morning, Nick. Well, no thunderstorms warnings today, which makes a change, but there is some wet weather in the forecast. And across England and Wales, it's a very cloudy start this morning, very muggy, actually, across the southeast of England. We are seeing some showers or some longer spells of rain around at the moment. Those will push very slowly eastwards. Still the risk of showers well into the afternoon across East Anglia and the southeast, but elsewhere should tend to become dry and brighter with some sunshine, although late in the afternoon we'll see more cloud bringing a few showers into the far west of England and Wales. Now, typical temperatures in England and Wales will be 19 or 20 degrees. In those western areas it will be a little bit cooler than that, and it could potentially be a bit warmer in East Anglia and the south east if we do see some sunshine away from those showers. But we start with some sunshine in Scotland this morning. It will tend to cloud over though from the west, and we'll see some showery bursts of rain pushing eastwards across Scotland, particularly during the afternoon. Some late sunshine coming into westernmost parts of the country. And across Northern Ireland, quite a bit of cloud. Already a few showers arriving. Those will again push their way eastwards to give some sunshine from mid to late afternoon onwards. But temperatures in Scotland and Northern Ireland, typically 16 or 17 degrees. Does become drier in most places overnight tonight. Temperatures could get down to a chilly 5 or 6 degrees in eastern Scotland and the northeast of England, 8 to 11 elsewhere. And then tomorrow, whilst we'll see some sunshine at times, there will be more showers breaking out through the day, and if anything it will be a little bit cooler than today.
Darren, thank you very much. 8 minutes past six. Let's turn to the papers, many of which focus on Britain's decision to restrict some arms sales to Israel. The Guardian's front page points out that the UK has broken with the US by changing its policy on weapons exports. The Eye says the Foreign Secretary David Lammy sent a stark message to the Israeli government. The Times calls the measure a PR exercise, which is designed to insulate Labour from any domestic fallout. But the Daily Mirror says continuing to supply the arms would have risked contributing to war crimes. The website of the Jewish Chronicle says Jewish and pro-Israel groups have reacted with disappointment. It quotes the Jewish Leadership Council as saying that when the bodies of the six murdered hostages are still being buried, it is more important than ever for the UK to stand by its ally.
The Daily Mail on its front page says the Conservatives have accused Sir Keir Starmer of running scared from giving MPs a say on plans to axe winter fuel payments for millions of pensioners. The paper says government sources have indicated ministers would reject calls for a Commons debate and vote. The Prime Minister has defended the cut, which he says is needed to fill what he calls a £22 billion black hole in the public finances.
The Express leads with Kemi Badenoch's pitch to lead the Conservatives. In an editorial, it says the shadow community's secretary has got off to a strong start. The paper says among very strong candidates for the leadership, she has some of the most visionary plans to heal what it describes as a wounded party. The Financial Times, meanwhile, describes her campaign launch speech as policy light.
One of Britain's biggest car dealerships, Vertu Motors, has told The Telegraph that manufacturers are delaying deliveries of petrol vehicles to avoid fines. The company suggests that car makers are rationing the cars so they don't exceed yearly quotas set by the government, designed to increase the proportion of electric vehicle sales. It tells the paper that customers ordering a petrol or hybrid vehicle today at some dealerships will have to wait until February for their cars to be delivered.
Continuing complaints about inflated ticket prices for the Oasis comeback tour are in several of the papers under the headline "Pulling the Plug on Oasis Wonderhall." The Mirror says the Prime Minister's hinted the law could change to stop event companies from charging more when demand surges. The Times' headline says some might say it's too late. The article quotes the consumer group Which, saying the high level of demand for Oasis tickets was clear from the outset.
The Sun says the football pundit, the former player Alan Shearer, had to hide for 4 hours on a train to avoid hundreds of fans of Sunderland, arch rivals of his old club, Newcastle. Shearer told the Rest Is Politics, Rest Is Football podcast he got in a busy carriage on his way home from a wedding on Saturday, only to realise it was also full of Sunderland supporters coming back from an away game against Portsmouth. The paper says he hid his face under a cap and was petrified when jubilant fans started singing about him and his former club. But despite the chanting, he managed to finish the journey without being recognised.
11 minutes past six is the time. The Chief Inspector of Ofsted, the school's watchdog in England, will be with us live just before eight as a report is published that is deeply critical of the organisation's response to the suicide of head teacher Ruth Perry in January last year. Aina Aslam, our correspondent, is here with us in a studio. How critical is the report?
So defensive and complacent, that's how the Independent Review has described Ofsted's response to Ruth Perry's death, the head teacher who took her life while waiting for a report that downgraded her school in Reading from outstanding to inadequate. Now, Dame Christine Gilbert's damning review found a climate of fear and frustration around inspections that had been building for years, it says. It says in the months after Ms. Perry's suicide, Ofsted made no attempt to contact her family or send a letter of condolence. And despite senior leaders knowing about the death, many staff and board members weren't told about it. Instead, the review says Ofsted seemed to assume it had done nothing wrong and that the failure to critically reflect increased damage to its reputation. Dame Christine said Ofsted's culture needs to be more open if it wants to learn from the tragedy, and that the watchdog needs to move away from the discourse that inspectors are never wrong.
And she has made a whole series of recommendations, most of which Ofsted has already said it's accepting.
Yeah, that's right. So some of them, she said there needs to be better communication in crisis situations, more external oversight over complaints and surveys. She called for more mental health training for inspectors to spot when school staff are distressed or anxious, and noted that this needs to be designed to reflect the unique power dynamic of inspection. She also said some people had raised concerns that management appeared to chase a greater volume of inspections over quality because of recent budget cuts. She said this should be the other way around, to give inspections a more human face. Now, as you say, Ofsted's chief inspector, Sir Martin Oliver, has accepted most of the review's findings. He said it was difficult to strike the balance between reducing unnecessary pressure on the schools they work with while calling out poor practice and low standards without fear or favour. But he said it was now time to act.
Aina Aslam, thank you very much. And Sir Martin will join us at 10 to 8.
It is now 13 minutes past six. What will the Scottish Government cut to make its budget numbers add up? We'll get the answer to that question later today. Let's talk about it with our Scotland correspondent, Katie Hundle. What do we know so far, Katie?
Well, Nick, we don't know the exact details of what's coming here at Holyrood this afternoon, but we're expecting substantial cuts to Scottish Government spending in the current financial year. People might remember that last month Scotland's Finance Secretary Shona Robison warned the Scottish Government would have to make difficult choices to fund pay increases for public sector staff. So there's already a freeze on all but essential recruitment. We also know that not all pensioners will continue to receive the winter fuel payment. That will be means tested in future. That's, of course, the case for other parts of the UK too. And concerns over cuts to an arts fund here in Scotland. We're in Edinburgh. The Edinburgh Festival season's just finished here, and some performers have been using their platforms to protest against that. So these are some of the areas we know about, but more cuts will come this afternoon as the Scottish Government tries to balance its books.
And we're in the middle of a political blame game, aren't we? Just as Labour is trying to blame the Tories for cuts it's making, the SNP north of the border are blaming Labour for the cuts they're about to make.
Absolutely. Worth mentioning that last week, the independent Scottish Fish School Commission said that while UK government policies contributed to pressure on the Scottish budget, that much of that pressure comes from the Scottish government's own decisions. And ahead of today's statement, the Finance Secretary, Shona Robison, has said that the UK is entering what she describes as a new era of austerity under Labour at Westminster. The Scottish government, she says, will do everything it can to protect people and services from UK government cuts to its budget. The UK government, for its part, said that it's been clear that, you know, tough decisions need to be taken to restore what it describes as economic credibility and address the hole in the public finances it says was left by the last government. So like you say, a bit of a blame game going on here, political parties blaming each other. But what matters most to many people is how the cuts announced here at Holyrood this afternoon will impact on their day-to-day lives.
Katie Hunter, thanks for joining us.
6:15 is the time. There are more signs that the UK economy is gaining momentum. This time they've come from our factories. Felicity Hannah has more in the business news. Morning, Fliss.
Good morning. Yes, August has been the strongest month for the UK's manufacturing sector in more than 2 years. This is according to the latest PMI survey from S&P Global. The index rose to 52.5. That is the highest level since June 2022. And if you're wondering what 52.5 means, essentially anything that's more than 50 indicates growth. Let's talk to Sambit Banerjee, who's joint CEO of Siemens Mobility UK and Ireland. It provides rail traffic technology and rail infrastructure. Sambit, good morning.
Good morning, Felicity. How are you?
Well, I'm interested in this because S&P have said in this survey that output, new orders, employment, all on the up. Does that tally with what you're seeing?
Absolutely. This is great news for UK and UK manufacturing sector. And I think in a very small way, Siemens Mobility has contributed to those numbers. We have started mobilizing for production in our Gull factory in North Yorkshire. In the last 3-4 months, we have stepped up that mobilization in a big way. And we have added to our recruitment over the last 6 months by about 150 people. In this time period. And it's so good to see all that getting reflected in numbers from a neutral body.
Okay, so you've definitely contributed to these numbers. And what's behind that growth for Siemens Mobility?
We consider UK as our home market. And we are set up a state-of-the-art manufacturing facility in Gool, where we are at the moment going to produce 79 of the 94 Piccadilly line trains for London. And then we have also our state-of-the-art facility in Chippenham. And Siemens Mobility has invested further 100 million there to upgrade that to a new facility. And this is our global production center where we actually serve our global market. And this has really a very strong confidence on the UK economy and the UK market.
So you're feeling very confident. We are expecting, of course, a painful budget in October. Not my word, the Prime Minister's word. Are you concerned about what spending cuts, tax rises might mean for your business and for your ability to continue this investment?
The concern is always there. Our request to the government has been that we need certainty from the market so that the pipeline and the orders are awarded at the right time. And this, then we can invest in the manufacturing sector, not only on our side, but particularly also help downstream, so small and medium manufacturers to come and grow with us. And our request to the government is stability and certainty towards the rail sector.
And what if that stability and certainty was, you know, certain tax cuts, certain tax rises rather, and certain spending cuts?
For us, the certainty is more about the pipeline of the orders to be awarded. Because if there is a dry spell, then our factories dry out. The numbers that you are seeing growing, very soon you will see having a reverse trend if the manufacturing slows down. And only way to go get the manufacturing numbers up, the GDP up, is the continuous production in all our factories.
And you mentioned recruiting 150 more staff members. I mean, when it comes to finding the right workers, are you able to find people with the right qualifications? Are you able to give them the training that they need?
We are completely committed on apprenticeship, training, internship programs. And the beauty is all our Piccadilly line trains will be mostly manufactured by young boys and girls coming through our apprenticeship pipelines from Yorkshire and the bigger catchment area of Goole. We are getting very, very good talents from the catchment area, and we are very hopeful that together we can really have a very bright future.
Sambit Banerjee, Joint CEO of Siemens Mobility UK and Ireland, thank you so much for being on the programme this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Let's look at a manufacturing story a bit further afield. Volkswagen has said it's considering closing one of its factories in Germany for the first time in its 87-year history. The car giant needs to make 10 billion euros in savings by 2026. I'm joined by Colleen McHugh, Chief Investment Officer at Wealthify. Colleen, good morning.
Good morning, Felicity.
So the chief executive of VW, Oliver Blume, said in a statement yesterday that the economic environment has become tougher. New players are pushing into Europe, particularly from China, and Germany itself is falling behind as a place to do business. These are some very strong words from a company that's very iconic for Germany.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, Germany, unlike the UK, is going through a manufacturing recession. And yesterday's numbers just validated that. You're right, like no other company, Volkswagen really symbolizes, you know, German manufacturing. It consumes up to 20% of Germany GDP. So massively important.
Wow.
The stock itself, it's had a really rough couple of years, blindsided a little bit, I think, by the rapid advance of EVs coming out of China. And you're seeing those imports into Europe, into its own turf, really impacting the company. Share price had a rotten year. It's down nearly 14-15% year to date. And over the last 5 years, it really hasn't been a good story.
Let's talk about a very good share price story. Rightmove shares jumped 27% after those reports that the Australian real estate listing provider REA Group is considering buying the company. Now, if you haven't heard of REA, it's part of Rupert Murdoch's News Corp empire. It said it's considering a cash and share offer for the UK's biggest property portal. Colleen, 27% jump in its share price, pretty remarkable. What did that do for Rightmove's market value?
Yeah, a lovely bump in the market cap yesterday, Felicity. So Rightmove is the UK's dominant property listing company. It's got about 80% of the market share in the UK. And really, you know, yesterday's news is just another example of overseas companies. They're seeing value in UK companies whose valuations have just been beaten down over the last few years. Nice pop in the share price. Year to date, it's up about sort of 27%.
A nice bump, a lovely pop. REA says it hasn't actually approached Rightmove yet. Why do you think it's interested in coming into the UK and buying up a brand here?
I think it's on the back of that. There's value in that particular segment. We saw in December, you might recall, on the market, which was a smaller rival to Rightmove, that was acquired in December by US real estate firm CoStar Group. So certainly value to be had, and it makes sense. I mean, you're right. There's nothing set in stone yet. REA Group have until, I think, it's the end of September to make a formal offer. So we'll wait and see what happens over the next few weeks.
I'm sure we'll be talking about it more then. Colleen McHugh, Chief Investment Officer at Wealthify, thank you very much indeed. Now, the global shipping container industry has had a challenging year. There have been those attacks by Houthi rebels in the Red Sea, causing long diversions for shipping around southern Africa. It hasn't hurt profits, though. Analysis by the industry expert John McCowan has found the industry made £7.6 billion for the second quarter of this year, with some of the world's major carriers seeing profits almost double. Nick Brown is the CEO of the maritime professional services organisation Lloyd's Register. Joins me now. Nick, good morning.
Good morning, Felicity.
I mean, a year of real challenge, real change for the shipping industry, and yet this significant rise in profits. What's going on?
Well, I think this year has been just another year of global disruption following the global pandemic, where we had a situation where the 2 million seafarers that operate global shipping were unable to get on and off vessels around the world. Then we've seen droughts in Panama, effectively rendering the number of vessels that can pass the Panama Canal much more reduced, and ships having to divert around South America. Of course, the conflict in Russia and Ukraine has meant that oil and gas and its normal flows of where the energy is produced and where it's consumed has been significantly disrupted. And now, of course, terrible situation in Israel and Palestine, leading to effectively the Red Sea being closed and the vast majority of the world's shipping effectively having to divert around Africa rather than use the Suez Canal. So a significant number of years where natural, or if you like, traditional shipping transportation and the amount of miles that ships would carry their cargoes have been completely disrupted.
Listeners might be confused as to why that translates into profits almost doubling.
Well, ultimately, there are a limited number of ships in the world. And of course, the same amount of cargo still needs to be carried from A to B. And what's quite often misunderstood is 90% of global trade is carried by shipping. 90% of everything we rely on in our supermarkets, our ability to heat our homes and transport ourselves and our goods around the world with fuel, everything we rely on, hospitals and schools, all reaches its destination from shipping and indeed raw materials. So that, as the global economy grows, the amount of cargo that needs to be transported grows, and yet there are the same amount of ships. So if the distances that are being travelled are increased by some kind of disruption, such as the Red Sea situation we see today, then that means that the ships need to be longer at sea, there's less ships available, and therefore the cost or price of shipping increases.
I see. Now, you've announced the deal to take over the maritime technology company Ocean Technologies Group. Is that a sign of your confidence in the industry?
It's a sign of the both the challenges and the opportunity that exist in the industry. I mentioned just now that we have a reliance on just 2 million seafarers globally to transport 90% of global trade. And yet the industry is becoming increasingly complex. It's becoming increasingly regulated. It's becoming increasingly connected thanks to low-orbit satellites and the ability to connect ships to shore much more easily. And, of course, we're going through our own energy transition and supporting the global energy transition and moving away from fossil fuels. So our organisation has focused for the last 260 years on ensuring that the ship itself is designed correctly, built correctly, and then maintained correctly. And our investment in Ocean Technologies Group ensures that we can put the same amount of focus and support to the seafarers and ultimately the people that are operating their vessels.
Okay. Nick Brown, CEO of Lloyd's Register, thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you, Fliss. 27 minutes past six. Simon Mundy's here with the sport. Big night for British tennis.
A very big night. A passing of the baton, one might say, yes, because we are starting at the US Open in New York, where Jack Draper is through to a Grand Slam quarterfinal for the first time in his career. The British number one beat Thomas Mahach in straight sets, 6-3, 6-1, 6-2, a demolition job. Now, Draper's yet to drop a set and is clearly full of confidence.
I just need to keep going. You know, I've got amazing people around me. I love playing here in New York in front of such amazing fans who are always getting behind and supporting the players. And I just go for it again. I love playing on these big stages. So I look forward to coming out here again on Wednesday.
The last time a British man reached the last eight in New York was Sir Andy Murray back in 2016. That was the year he finished the season as world number one. Murray, of course, retired after the Olympics a few weeks ago. And Draper clearly feels his absence.
I obviously miss Andy. Shout out to Andy. You know, what an unbelievable career the guy's had. Icon of the game. I miss him in the change rooms. I miss being next to his stinky shoes and all his stinky clothes, you know. But, you know, Andy's a legend. And, you know, if I have half the career that he's had, then, you know, I'll be a happy man. So I'm looking forward to it.
In the last eight tomorrow, Draper will face Australia's 10th seed Alex de Minaur for a place in the semi-finals. Now, de Minaur is one of the fastest players on tour and has won all three previous matches with Jack Draper. The men's top seed, Jannik Sinner, is also through to the last eight after an imperious straight sets win over the American Tommy Paul. He'll play Daniil Medvedev next in a match between the only two Grand Slam champions left in the men's draw. In the women's, the top seed, Iga Świątek, is through to the last eight. She beat Lidmila Samsonova 6-4, 6-1 and now faces the American American. Sixth seed Jessica Pegula, that's tomorrow. Italy's Jasmine Paolini is out. The French and Wimbledon finalists lost in the fourth round to Karolina Muchova. At the Paralympics in Paris, there were six gold medals for Paralympics GB on day five. Among the highlights, archers Nathan McQueen and Jodie McQueen claimed gold in the mixed team compound open final. And in the swimming pool, Ellie Challis dominated the women's S3 50 metres backstroke final, while Louise Fiddes won the S14 100 metres.
It's going to be so tight here, Fiddes, into the last 5 metres. I think she's going to touch the wall first, and she does. She's got it. Louise Fiddes of Great Britain has another gold medal for Great Britain in the pool here. She looks up at the big screen. She's got a hand up to her mouth. She cannot believe what she's just done there.
And amputee sprinter Johnny Peacock finished fifth in the final of the men's T64 100 metres. The double Paralympic champion clocked a time of 10.91 seconds. And Paralympics GB have the opportunity to win yet more gold medals today. Among the highlights in the pool, Ellie Challis will look up to keep up the medal momentum in the S3 100 metres freestyle. Tully Kearney also goes for her third gold of the games in the women's S5 50 metres backstroke. And in the para-equestrian, Natasha Baker goes for her seventh Paralympic gold when she competes in the Grade 3 individual dressage event this morning. That's at 9 a.m.
Simon, thank you very much.
Drift away with the sleeping forecast. A gentle mix of ambient music and the restful sounds of Radio 4's shipping forecast.
Fourth, Thai, Bogger, Fisher, German Bike, Humber, South or Southwest.
Handcrafted to soothe your soul. The Sleeping Forecast. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Curiously, I thought we were trying to wake you up rather than send you back to sleep. But I have to say, I use the Sleeping Forecast sometimes to go to sleep. It's very soothing, actually.
Does it do the job?
And the music. Yes, it does.
Okay.
Generally.
For us at 8 o'clock at night.
Mm. Now, you're listening to Today, just in case you are awake, on BBC Radio 4 with Michelle Lassane and Nick Robinson. And it's time at 29 minutes to 7 for a summary of the news from Caroline Nichols.
The chief rabbi has condemned the government's decision to suspend some arms exports to Israel because of concerns about possible violations of international law in Gaza. Sir Ephraim Mervis says the announcement beggars belief and, as he puts it, feeds the falsehood that Israel is in breach of the rules. Some Labour MPs have criticised the government for not going further. Scotland's Finance Secretary Shona Robison is expected to announce hundreds of millions of pounds in cuts to public spending for the current financial year. It's thought, she'll say, she's been left with no choice because of UK government cuts. Critics accuse the SNP of incompetence. The Cabinet Secretary, Simon Case, has said the last Conservative government's decision not to hold a new spending review contributed to the current uncertainty about the public finances. Mr. Case made his remarks in a letter seen by the BBC, which he sent to the former Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, who'd complained about Labour's claim to have inherited a £22 billion black hole. An independent review has criticised the way Ofsted responded to the death of the head teacher Ruth Perry, who killed herself after learning that her school was being downgraded by inspectors. The report says the watchdog made no attempt to contact her family and seemed to assume it had done nothing wrong. Five seabirds have been added to the UK's red list of species at most risk. They're the Arctic tern, famed for its epic migrations, the giant skua, which has been hit by bird flu, the little-known leeches storm petrel, and two types of gull, the common gull and the great black-backed gull. The latest British social attitudes survey suggests that people are considerably less proud of Britain than they were a decade ago. The proportion of those saying they'd rather be a citizen of Britain than of any other country has fallen from 62% to 49%.
Caroline, thank you very much. The time is just after 6:30. Some arms sales to Israel are being suspended. It is a partial ban, the Foreign Secretary says, on items which could be used in the current conflict in Gaza. It is a decision that comes as funerals of hostages take place amid the deaths of more Palestinians in Gaza and amid an ongoing major Israeli operation in the occupied West Bank. James Landale, our diplomatic correspondent, joins us from Jerusalem. James, which arms exports are affected by this?
What the government has said is that of the existing 350 licences that are currently in operation selling UK arms to Israel, 30 of those licences are going to be suspended. They relate to weapons that are used in aircraft, they say, drones, ground targeting equipment, but they're giving no more details than that. So militarily, it is very, very small indeed. The UK exports to Israel on arms are relatively small compared to Israel's total. Most of their arms come from the United States. So it is politically significant more than it is militarily.
Would it have come after advice from government lawyers?
Oh, yeah, this is an incredibly legal process. The government has been looking at this since before Christmas. The previous administration started this whole process. They've came quite close to it at times. The previous government making very clear they weren't going to publish any of the internal advice. But there has been a long debate in the British government about this. So this announcement that was being made has come as no surprise to the Israelis, but it has still dismayed many of them, simply, I think, not just because, you know, it isn't a criticism of Israel. It is an ally saying that there is a clear risk that some weapons being sold to Israel could be used to violate international humanitarian law. But I think, as you said in your introduction, the sheer timing has hit home here, simply because the announcement was made on the same day that there were funerals taking place for some of the hostages that were killed by Hamas last week.
We've heard in the news some of the reaction from prominent Jewish leaders in the UK, the chief rabbi, for example, who represents and leads the United Synagogue, which is the biggest wing of Orthodox Judaism in the UK. But what has been the reaction from Israeli leaders?
The Defence Minister, Yoav Gallant, said the decision was deeply disheartening. Another minister, the Energy Minister, Eli Cohen, said that the decision boosted Hamas, what he called a brutal organisation that murders babies. Amichai Chikli, the Diaspora Minister, said that the decision was disappointing and it sent the wrong message. So there is just a sort of, I think, a slight sort of sense in Israel that where at the moment emotions are high, politics is incredibly visceral, there's a question mark about the timing of this announcement. This announcement, the Labour government clearly made the decision to make this decision when MPs came back for the beginning of the parliamentary term so that it could be made in a formal statement to Parliament. But the sheer fact that it happened on the same day of those funerals, so soon after the killing of those hostages, meant that a lot of questions have been raised by people in commentary in Israeli media about why it was done at this precise time. So they're not happy with it, and I think the sense will be that, you know, is this the start of a chillier diplomatic wind from European allies? You know, will the British decision in any way, you know, be replicated by other countries in the future?
James, thank you very much. The Defence Secretary will be with us at 8:10.
7:23 now. Who's telling the truth about whether the Conservatives left a black hole in the nation's finances? It's a charge made again and again by Keir Starmer and his ministers, and it's hotly denied by the man who was Chancellor until a few weeks ago, Jeremy Hunt. He wrote to the nation's top civil servant to ask him to stop ministers using incorrect information as he saw it. Our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman, has seen the reply from the Cabinet Secretary. And it says what, Henry?
Morning, Nick. Well, this is all afters, really, from Rachel Reeves's extraordinary statement in July when she unveiled what she said was this £22 billion black hole. Jeremy Hunt was furious with that, but he also wrote to Simon Case, as you say, the head of the civil service, the cabinet secretary, questioning how this could be reconciled with formal spending plans that had been signed off by senior civil servants and presented to Parliament just days beforehand. And I've been leaked this reply from Simon Case. Now, a lot of it is fairly technical stuff. I'll spare you the passages about supplementary estimates and main estimates. But to condense it and simplify it, he basically says that that was all an inevitable result of the snap general election condensing the parliamentary timetable before the summer. But then Simon Case goes further. He says, I would also note that the sizable in-year changes to spending plans in recent years have resulted from the lack of a new spending review to replan departmental budgets in the face of significant pressures which have materialised since budgets were set in 2021. I mean, that appears to be a fairly clear, pointed criticism of Jeremy Hunt and his previous Conservative government. He also says at a later point, unlike previous years, this government has set out to Parliament the pressures that it is having to manage down and the actions it is taking to do so. So just a couple of really notable pointed moments in what was, I stress, meant to be a private letter to the former Chancellor.
So if Jeremy Hunt and the Conservatives were hoping he'd act as a sort of referee, the Cabinet Secretary, giving Labour a yellow card, it sounds from you as if he's waved away the opposition's complaints.
I think that's exactly right. Now, allies of Jeremy Hunt last night were professing to be kind of unsurprised that the Cabinet Secretary, who serves the government of the day, is essentially repeating the government of the day's position. But look, if all this sounds like a kind of insufferable burst of claim and counterclaim and counterclaim, well, get used to it, because I think what this letter is part of is the big questions which are going to shape the coming weeks in the run-up to the budget, but also months and years in British politics. The question of, is there an economic black hole? And the question of, if so, is the government making the right tax and spend decisions in response? And that is certainly, by the way, going to shape today in Westminster when Jeremy Hunt and Rachel Reeves face off at the dispatch box for the first time since she made that black hole claim back in July.
Yep, Parliament is back. Our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman, thanks.
20 to 7, nearly 80,000 people in England and Wales had smartphones snatched from them in the street last year. That's according to government analysis of crime survey data. There will now be a Home Office summit on this type of theft. Rowan Bridge is our North of England correspondent. And in percentage terms, Rowan, it is a very striking increase.
Oh, yeah, massive. 150% rise in snatch thefts over the year before. So we're comparing the year up to March 2024 with the year to March 2023. So this is based on analysis of the Crime Survey of England and Wales, which is seen as the most authoritative view of crime in England and Wales, because rather than relying on what is reported to the police, it goes and asks people about their experiences. And as you say, in the year up to March last year, that was estimated that 78,000 people had phones or bags snatched. The year before that, 31,000. The Home Office says it's more than 200 incidents a day across England and Wales. But if you then look at what happens, how many people are actually charged, that is less than 1% of offenders. And over 80% of investigations are closed before a suspect is found. Police say this problem is being driven by the demand in the second-hand market. But as you can see, what you've got is a situation where the problem appears to be getting worse, but the chances of anybody actually being caught for that are pretty slim.
And why is that? People will know that this happens very quickly. Often it's people on mopeds snatching phones out of people's hands in the street. Do they literally then disappear, the offenders?
Yeah, I mean, or sometimes it can be surreptitious. So I know, for example, there have been problems at certain tube stations in London where people will quickly put somebody's hand into the back of their bag, be able to take the phone out before the person has even realised what has happened. And then it becomes very difficult to kind of find those people. So the police have been tasked with trying to get a better intelligence picture around who it is who's stealing those phones, where they end up, to get a better picture of the stolen market and identify what needs to be done. But the policing minister, Dame Diana Johnson, also wants more to be done by the tech companies and the phone makers to make it less attractive for phones to be stolen. So to kind of build on the anti-theft features some smartphones already have. So some phones, for example, you can wipe remotely, you can track them once they've been stolen. But clearly, there is still a significant problem. It is still significantly lucrative for criminals to steal those phones.
Rowan Bridge, thank you.
It is now 18 minutes to 7. Let's take a look at what's making the front pages of the newspapers this morning. The decision of the government to suspend arms export licences, or at least some of them, to Israel, makes the front pages of many papers. Interesting commentary inside as well. The Guardian says in its coverage that the decision is likely to help David Lammy, the Foreign Secretary, overcome a potential revolt on the floor of the Labour Party conference to be held in a few weeks' time. Inside the Times, it's interesting that they note the contortions of the Foreign Secretary. We're about to hear some of that in yesterday in Parliament when he tries to explain what this is not.
It is not a blanket ban, he told the Commons. It is not an arms embargo. It will not have a material effect on Israeli security. He was not in any way trying to punish Israel, he said, trying to explain that his decision was quasi-legal. More on that with the Defence Secretary at 10 past eight.
Kemi Badenoch is pictured on the front page of the Daily Telegraph after the launch of her campaign to be the next Tory leader, where she criticised her party for talking right but governing left. The Telegraph's main story comes from a leading car dealership chain, which has said that drivers in Britain face a shortage of petrol and hybrid cars because manufacturers are rationing vehicles to avoid large net zero fines. Carmakers are delaying deliveries until next year, Vertu Motors says, amid fears that they will breach quotas set by the government for electric vehicle sales. This means someone ordering a petrol or hybrid car today at some dealerships will not receive it until February.
Red faces inside number 10. They forgot the Prime Minister's birthday. The Guardian has revealed.
Whereas we remembered it yesterday morning.
Well, it was. It was revealed by number 10 inside to all journalists. And they get a briefing when asked how the Prime Minister marked his birthday. I think we all forgot, as the spokesperson, to wish him a happy birthday at the 8:30 this morning, which I feel a bit embarrassed about. What he's done about it, we do not have a report. We'll bring it to you if we do. Now, let's bring you the main news this morning. The chief rabbi said the UK's decision to suspend some arms sales to Israel beggars belief and will encourage the country's two shared enemies. I mentioned yesterday in Parliament that decision by the Foreign Secretary announced the suspension of some arms export licences to Israel. Here's our parliamentary correspondent, Susan Hume.
August is supposed to be the month for news about simple things like the weather and holiday traffic jams. But the surge and swell of human affairs while Parliament was in recess meant there was pent-up demand for a whole series of ministerial question sessions. In one, the Foreign Secretary David Lammy announced the suspension of 30 arms export licences to Israel. He told MPs there was a clear risk that British components might be used in action which broke international law. He conceded that Israel's opponents weren't bothered about that sort of thing.
There can be no doubt that Hamas pays not the slightest heed to international humanitarian law. It endangers civilians by embedding itself in the tightly concentrated civilian population and in civilian infrastructure.
He said there was no equivalence between Hamas and Israel's democratic government.
But to license arms exports to Israel, we must assess their compliance with international humanitarian law, notwithstanding the abhorrence of their opponents' tactics and ideology.
Some MPs, though, thought the government should do more and ban all arms exports to Israel. And Lib Dem Leila Moran had another suggestion.
I urge the government to go further. Will they not ban goods produced in the illegal Israeli settlements? If the settlements are illegal, why are we allowing trade with them?
The Conservatives' Shadow Foreign Secretary, Andrew Mitchell, said he would look carefully at the decision on arms sales, though later on he took to social media to criticise it. The DUP's Sammy Wilson didn't need time to decide what he thought.
The only people who will be overjoyed by this decision today will be the Hamas terrorists who murdered in cold blood six hostages at the weekend. They have been handed a line of hope that this government will not stand firm in its defence of Israel's right to defend itself.
David Lammy reminded him that Labour had supported the deployment of British fighter planes to defend Israel when it came under attack from Iranian missiles earlier this year. After the Foreign Secretary, next up was the Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, to talk about the riots which followed the murders of three young girls at a dance class in Southport. She said the rioters were not protesting. This was racism, thuggery and crime.
Plenty of people across the country have strong views about crime, about policing, about immigration, asylum, the NHS and more, but they don't pick up bricks and throw them at the police.
Her Conservative shadow, the former Home Secretary James Cleverly, paid tribute to the bravery of the police who tackled the rioters, but he also thought there were double standards at work.
The Labour leadership kneeling in the immediate aftermath of the Black Lives Matter disorder, when violent protesters attacked police officers, looks like her party takes some forms of violence less seriously than other forms of violence.
Yvette Cooper shrugged that off as a pitch by James Cleverly to Conservative members as part of his campaign to become party leader. Patrick Hurley is the Labour MP for Southport, where the initial attack on the dance class took place. He called it a grotesque lie that the rioters had been driven to violence by the killings of the little girls.
It's no surprise to me that some of the targets of the violence were places of worship, Citizens Advice Bureau, a library. These are the places where communities go when they heal each other, when they are driven to improve themselves. And the thugs who attacked those targets set their face against that community self-improvement.
A Conservative, Sir Julian Lewis, seemed to rather admire the way the rioters had been dealt with.
One of the reasons why what might be called her shock and awe policy successfully shut down the violence so quickly was the speed with which the offenders were brought before the courts and sentenced.
He reckoned swift retribution might just work in other areas too. Yvette Cooper agreed, but said the delays and damage to the criminal justice system needed to be turned around for that to happen.
Susan Hume reporting on Yesterday in Parliament. The time is 10 to 8. Twitter, now X, 10 to 7, sorry. X is to remain inaccessible in Brazil after the country's Supreme Court upheld a ban that began with the blocking of individual accounts linked to disinformation. Zoe Kleinman, our technology editor, joins us now. So this seems to have snowballed quite a lot since those initial moves, Zoe.
Yes, it's become an absolute standoff, I think it's fair to say, between a judge in Brazil and Elon Musk. At the heart of this row, as you said, are accounts which the Brazilian judge has accused of spreading disinformation. They're believed to have been linked to the former president of Brazil, President Bolsonaro. X has refused to appoint a legal representative in the country, which is what it was ordered to do. It says that that would have just led to intimidation and censorship. And as a result, well, censorship, I suppose, has happened in some form because the entire platform has now been blocked in Brazil since Saturday. Elon Musk was busy posting previously that there are, of course, ways around this. You can use a virtual private network which disguises the location of your device and sometimes lets you get around blocks like this. But the authorities have hit back and said there'll be a £7,000 fine for people who are caught doing that. Blue Sky, which is an alternative network, says it's registered half a million new Brazilian users since this all happened. And there's just no sign really of how this is going to work its way out. I think it's really interesting because what we're seeing here is a very sort of swift and decisive and strong action against the content that's being shared on a social network and holding that social network responsible. And as you know, we've seen for years situations where all the big tech companies have tried to fight against that and said, you know, we're just the platform, we're not the publisher, we can't have this responsibility. And now we're seeing enforcement saying, well, actually, yes, you can.
Do you think the same kind of move could happen in other countries?
I'm absolutely certain that other countries are watching this closely. And I think whether or not they'll follow suit is going to have to depend on a case-by-case basis, isn't it? I mean, completely separately, but there are links. We've seen the arrest of the boss of Telegram in France. And while, of course, that's not connected, it is again this row over responsibility for content that's being shared on this network. We're seeing new legislation come in the UK. We've got the Online Safety Act. In the EU, we've got the Digital Services Act. And I'll tell you what's quite interesting. We know that social networks, including X, used to spread and share disinformation during the UK riots that happened recently here. And previously, I've heard from all the big social networks telling me about how much content they blocked and removed and how proactive they'd been in trying to police, if you like, their own networks. I've had nothing this time. It's been absolute tumbleweed. They're being very, very quiet about it. And I think, I suppose that's because by telling me that stuff, they're also admitting accountability in some ways, aren't they?
Zoe, thanks very much.
It is 8 minutes to, just turned 7 minutes to seven, in fact. Time for the lovely sound of the Coastal Dawn Chorus. That What's the common gull and an Arctic tern? You look at me, Michelle, it's not that lovely, actually, is it? Well, slightly quite, squawking, but...
Quite enjoying it.
Yeah. They're birds, just to add some worry to the lovely sounds, now on a UK red list of greatest conservation concern, alongside the great black-backed gull, the Arctic tern, the great skua and Leach's storm petrel. They've all been added to this so-called red list by, amongst others, Dawn Balmer of the British Trust for Ornithology, who joins us on the line. Morning to you.
Oh, good morning, Nick.
So five new birds on the red list. What makes you worry about them?
Oh, well, the seabirds, which we just heard there, a really important species in Britain and Ireland. We hold globally important populations here. So they're around our coast and the inland. And, some recent work counting that birds all across Britain and Ireland showed some really severe declines for some of these species, which led them to being added to the red list.
And what do you think is contributing to the decline in these populations?
Well, there's many things, actually. So some things such as changes in prey availability due to climate change and overfishing. Some get tangled up in fishing gear in our oceans, predators on islands. Climate impacts, of course, on nesting and the breeding success of the seabirds. And most recently, actually, disease. We all heard about the avian influenza over the last couple of years, and that impacted many of our seabirds too.
Now, what is it people can do, or groups like yours, the charities that work to preserve our bird populations, what can you do to actually try and sustain these populations and mean they're not at risk?
Well, that's quite tricky, actually. But one thing we can do is keep a good idea of the numbers of birds and their distribution around Britain, Ireland and across the inland sites by monitoring their populations. So we can see these changes over time. And that gives us very good information to be able to carry out these assessments into the future to look at the changes. But, we can do things like when we're placing new offshore renewable energies, new wind turbines off our coast, we can look at all the data we have available through such as birds that have been tracked to show their movements. So we can have better placements of those offshore turbines to make sure they sort of have as least impact on the bird populations as possible.
Because I think I'm right in saying, aren't I, that when new wind turbines are put up at sea, and we expect many more of them, don't we, in the coming years, the companies, the energy companies, have to make provision for the birds that have been displaced.
That's right, yeah. And for some species, that can be provision of new nesting habitats, such as kittiwake. There's been quite a lot of sort of artificial sort of nest towers provided for that species. But yeah, we've got a lot of information about the areas that the birds use, sort of for fish distribution. So we can give good advice as to the sort of best areas to avoid, really.
And just so a puzzle for us, because one of the birds we heard there was a common gull, and I think there'd be lots of people listening thinking, I hear them all over the place, towns, cities, not just at the seaside. Are you saying they really are under threat?
Yeah, so actually common gulls are really not that common, and we rarely see them in our towns and cities. They're very much birds of sort of open moorland, particularly up in Scotland. So that's the place I see them most in the breeding season, on the sort of vast moors. And the birds you probably see, and I actually hear in Norfolk, here around my town, are herring gulls, which are already on the red list, and lesser blackback gulls. They've really taken advantage of a lot of food resources around our towns and
cities. So they need to be renamed the uncommon gull. That's the confusion. I've confused the common gull with the common gull there. Yeah. Dawn Balmer of the British Trust for Ornithology, thanks for joining us.
Darren Bett now with the weather.
Thanks very much, Michelle. Good morning. Quite a range of temperatures across the UK first thing this morning. It's still very muggy for East Anglia and the South East, and temperatures are about 18 degrees. It was a more comfortable, much cooler night for sleeping in Scotland, where we've had the clearer skies. Temperatures currently around 5 Celsius in quite a few places. But we do have some early sunshine in Scotland, away from the far west, where we've got the cloud arriving already. And this cloud will push its way gradually eastwards across Scotland today. It'll bring with it a few showers. Late in the day, we'll get get some sunshine for the far west of Scotland as the rain clears away. Temperatures in Scotland around 16 or 17 degrees, as they will be really across many parts of Northern Ireland as well, where we're seeing the cloud moving in more quickly, some showers already. Those will tend to clear away and we'll see some sunshine developing during the afternoon. For England and Wales, quite a cloudy start here, very muggy in the southeast, as I say. We've got some showers or some longer spells of rain around, which will gradually push their way eastwards, keeping the risk of showers into the afternoon for East Anglia and the southeast. Other areas should tend to brighten up with a bit of sunshine coming through, although the far west of England and Wales will turn a bit more cloudy later with the odd shower. And temperatures here are around about 17 degrees through the Midlands, northeast England, 19 or 20 Celsius. A little bit warmer and certainly more humid across East Anglia and the southeast. If we do get some sunshine, temperatures will reach 23 Celsius.
Thank you very much indeed, Darren. Let's find out where the news quiz has been recently.
Hello, I'm Andy Zaltzman, just back from a trip to the future in the BBC's one remaining functioning time machine. Ahead of the new series of the News Quiz, I've been checking out how the news from now will be looked back on by the world in 100 years' time.
What on earth are you people doing?
Sorry, I think someone might have hitched a ride back. Anyway, they're a bit cross.
Honestly, what are you all thinking?
To find out why our future friends are not 100% in love with us, tune in over the next few weeks to the News Quiz. Friday nights, 6:30 comedy on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
And stay with us here. In the next hour, we'll be speaking to the Chief Inspector of Ofsted, as well as to the election guru, Sir John Curtis. He's back to tell us about his new findings that show pride in being British is on the decline. And we'll also speak to Rose Ayling Ellis, who is part of the presenting lineup at the Paralympics.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Michelle Hussain and Nick Robinson. Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Tuesday, the 3rd of September. The headlines this morning. The UK's chief rabbi said the government's decision to suspend some arms sales to Israel beggars belief. Scotland's finance secretary is expected to confirm hundreds of millions of pounds in cuts to public services. The head of the civil service has said the Conservatives' failure to conduct a spending review contributed to the uncertainty about the public finances, which Labour is calling a black hole. The BBC News is read this morning by Caroline Nichols.
The UK's chief rabbi, Sir Ephraim Mervis, has said it beggars belief that the British government has blocked some arms sales to Israel. The Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, told MPs yesterday that the UK was suspending around 30 of the existing 350 export licences, where there was a clear risk the items might be used to violate international humanitarian law. Sir Ephraim represents the United Synagogue, the biggest wing of Orthodox Judaism in the UK. Our political correspondent, Harry Farley, reports.
The government's announcement is more significant politically than militarily. UK arms exports are relatively small, less than 1% of Israel's total weapons imports. But it matters both diplomatically and domestically on a sensitive issue for the Labour Party. The chief rabbi, Sir Ephraim Mervis, who criticised Labour under Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, said the announcement would serve to encourage Israel and the UK's shared enemies. He added the timing, coming as funerals were held for some of the hostages found dead on Saturday, beggared belief. The Conservatives' Shadow Foreign Secretary Andrew Mitchell said the announcement had the appearance of something designed to satisfy Labour's backbenchers. But some Labour MPs, as well as other opposition parties, have criticised the government for not going further. They want a total ban on arms exports to Israel. A spokesman for the government said it was legally obliged to suspend export licences for arms that could be used in the current conflict. But the UK remained committed to Israel's security.
Hamas has threatened to kill more hostages in Gaza if Israel continues to use military force to try to free them. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has insisted he will not agree to a ceasefire and hostage release deal if any agreement involves his forces leaving southern Gaza. Our diplomatic correspondent James Landale reports from Jerusalem.
Pressure continues to mount on Benjamin Netanyahu. Protesters walked past his home in Jerusalem last night carrying empty coffins, symbols of the six hostages they believe he could have saved if he'd agreed a ceasefire with Hamas. President Biden said Israel's prime minister wasn't doing enough to secure a deal. But at a press conference, Mr. Netanyahu said no ceasefire could be agreed if it meant Israeli forces had to leave a buffer zone between Gaza and Egypt. He said he did not believe President Biden would seriously ask him to make concessions that rewarded Hamas for killing hostages. A Hamas spokesman said if Israel used military force to try to free the remaining hostages, they would be returned to their families in coffins.
Scotland's finance secretary, Shona Robertson, is expected to confirm today that she's making hundreds of millions of pounds in cuts to public services this financial year. The Scottish government says its budget has been reduced by Westminster. The UK government has blamed incompetence by both the SNP and the previous Conservative administration in London. Here's our Scotland editor, James Cook.
Shona Robertson says the UK is entering a new era of austerity, which will have a profound effect on the Scottish Government's ability to deliver services. The widespread cuts she will announce at Holyrood later come on top of measures already taken to reduce spending, including means-testing winter fuel payments, closing a fund for the arts, and ending some subsidised rail fares. The independent Scottish Fiscal Commission says much of the pressure on the budget comes from the SNP's own decisions, including freezing council tax and raising public sector pay. State-funded university tuition, prescriptions and welfare payments to poorer families are also expensive. But the Scottish Government says the root problem is that the UK is plagued by entrenched poverty and low growth, exacerbated by its departure from the European Union.
BBC News has seen a letter from the Cabinet Secretary Simon Case that suggests some actions taken by the Conservative government contributed to uncertainty about public spending. Mr. Case was replying to the former Chancellor Jeremy Hunt, who'd told him that Labour's claims to have inherited an economic black hole had brought the civil service into disrepute. Here's our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman.
When Rachel Reeves unveiled what she said was a shocking £22 billion spending gap in July, her predecessor as Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, was furious, not only attacking his political rival, but questioning why her figures differed from those signed off by civil servants just days before. In his private response to Mr. Hunt, leaked to the BBC, Simon Case, the Cabinet Secretary, said this mismatch was simply an inevitable result of the parliamentary timetable being warped by the sudden general election, and that the civil service had acted appropriately throughout. But then he went further, contending that sizeable in-year changes to spending plans in recent years were because of the last Conservative government's decision not to hold a new spending review, which would have updated departmental budgets at any point since 2021. Pointedly, he said that the new government had explained to Parliament the pressures that it is having to manage down, unlike previous years. An ally of Mr. Hunt said they were unsurprised that the head of the civil service was supporting the current government's position. A spokesperson for the Cabinet Office said it did not comment on leaks.
Data gathered by the BBC shows that councils across the UK have stopped running more than 180 libraries in the past 7 years. More than 900 other libraries, almost a third of the total, have had their opening hours reduced. The government said it recognised the pressures public libraries faced and it was committed to giving stability back to local councils. An independent review has found that Ofsted was defensive and complacent in its response to the suicide of the headteacher Ruth Perry. She took her own life in January last year after learning that the watchdog was downgrading her school. Ofsted's chief inspector has accepted most of the review's recommendations. Here's our education editor, Bramwyn Jeffries.
This independent review by Dame Christine Gilbert, a former chief inspector of schools, sets out the lessons Ofsted needs to learn. In the months after Ruth Perry took her life, Ofsted made no attempt to contact her family or send a letter of condolence. Ofsted's senior leaders did not inform its board, which is meant to hold it to account. Instead, this report says Ofsted seemed to assume it had done nothing wrong. It says that the failure to critically reflect within Ofsted increased the damage to the regulator's reputation. Even its own staff were not fully aware of the impact of the inspection until the coroner ruled it had contributed to Mrs. Perry's death. The former chief inspector, Amanda Spielman, who led the organisation until the end of last year, declined a BBC request to comment on the findings.
The Home Office is to hold a meeting with technology companies and manufacturers to examine ways to reduce thefts of mobile phones. They'll consider how to make it easier and quicker to disable a device permanently, so stolen phones are harder to sell. 5 more seabirds have been added to the UK's red list of birds which are most at risk. Here's our environment correspondent, Helen Briggs.
Britain's miles of coastline are home to globally important seabird colonies with more than 20 different species breeding on clifftops or foraging out at sea. But many populations are in trouble, hit by multiple pressures from climate change to overfishing. In the latest health check of seabirds, conservation groups have added 5 more species to the red list of British birds facing the highest level of conservation concern. The new additions are the Arctic tern, famed for its epic migrations, the giant skua, which has been hard hit by bird flu, the little-known leech's storm petrel, and 2 types of gull, the common gull and great black-backed gull. The RSPB is calling on the UK's authorities to turn around the fortunes for seabirds by improving marine protected areas and managing fisheries in a way that ensures seabirds have enough food.
A survey suggests there's been a sharp fall in national pride over the past decade. According to the National Centre for Social Research, the proportion of people saying they're proud of Britain's history has dropped from 86% to 64%. But the survey also suggests that Britain has become more inclusive in its attitudes. The proportion of people who believe someone needs to have been born here to be truly British has fallen from 3/4 to just over a half.
Caroline, thank you very much. The time is now 7:09. About a tenth of the current arms licences in place for exports to Israel are being suspended as part of the decision announced by the government yesterday. The Foreign Secretary said an assessment he'd received had left him unable to conclude anything other than certain UK arms exports to Israel carried a clear risk of being used to commit or facilitate serious violations of international humanitarian law. Some Jewish leaders think this is the wrong decision, or at least the wrong time for this decision. Phil Rosenberg is president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews. He says it sends the wrong signal to announce the move soon after the bodies of 6 Israeli hostages discovered in a tunnel in Gaza were returned to Israel.
On the day that those beautiful people were being buried, kidnapped from a music festival at Reading or Glastonbury, the UK decides to send a signal that it's Israel that it wants to penalise. And that is a terrible, terrible message to be sending both to Israel in its hour of need, also to Hamas about the consequences, where consequences are for the horrific actions that Hamas has taken, this terrorist organisation, but also to other allies and adversaries around the world. So it is the wrong decision taken very much at the wrong time.
Well, among the 6 is 23-year-old Hirsch Goldberg Polin, who had already had his arm blown off as he was seen being taken into Gaza seriously wounded. And in these 11 months of war, the health ministry in Gaza, which comes under Hamas, says at least 40,786 Palestinians have been killed in the war. More than 94,000 others have been wounded, the ministry says. Peter Ricketts, Lord Ricketts, is a former British diplomat and former national security advisor as well. Lord Ricketts, what do you make of the choice the government has made here, a partial suspension of these arms sales?
They've been very careful, I think. They've gone into this thoroughly and they've concluded that although they can't pin individual weapon systems to individual acts in Gaza because there aren't the number of observers on the ground to see it, they've reached a conclusion that there are certain weapons where there is a clear risk that if they were supplied, they would be used in a way that breaches international humanitarian law. And that is one of the conditions in the licences that we serve to all countries that get British arms. So I think their move is about the integrity of the arms export system rather than any hope that it might change Netanyahu's mind, which it clearly won't.
And that's done within a legal framework. And you will have seen in your career legal advice of this kind. Is there a discretion within that, or is there a real danger that if the government doesn't act in accordance with the legal advice it has internally, that there's a risk?
Well, there's certainly a risk. There's a risk of judicial review, for example, if they don't, and that could lead to the entire arms export licensing system being called into question. I mean, these things are never cut and dried. There are always going to be judgments to be made. Most weapons can be used for defensive or offensive action. So I think they've tried not to look at that. But what are the weapons that are most likely to be used in acts that could violate international law? And it will have been a careful assessment. Yes, gone over several months. The previous government launched the process of reviewing. And I think, honestly, this is long overdue. In fact, I called on this programme on the 1st of April. Mm. after that World Central Kitchen attack for a suspension. I think that they have made the right move. The timing I will leave to the minister to explain. Yeah.
But I guess I'm really asking that there is a political choice within this. There is a discretion that the government has, whatever the legal advice it receives.
Well, I think there comes a point where the legal advice is so clear the government has an obligation to follow it. I don't know quite what the legal advice was to the previous government. But yeah, this is a legal decision with strong political implications.
Yeah. And there's no doubt, is there, now, that from what we've seen, even in recent days, that this situation is growing bigger by the minute, bigger than Gaza. There's a big ongoing Israeli operation in the occupied West Bank. The BBC News website has a big investigation that it's done on the seizure of land in the West Bank as well. And there's the regional situation, whether it's Hezbollah or Iran.
Exactly. No, it's a very dangerous moment. And it's clearer and clearer, I think, that Netanyahu has no intention of signing up to a ceasefire on any conditions that would be acceptable. Nor do the Hamas leaders. We've got the leaders of both sides in this conflict unwilling to settle it. The problem is that the longer it goes on, the greater the tension mounts, as you say. I cannot understand how the Israeli government feels this is in the long-term interests of Israel to launch into a permanent occupation of Gaza. We see in the West Bank right now, after 50 years of Israeli occupation, there is certainly no security for Israel or rights for the Palestinian people. And as you say, we have not yet had an Iranian retaliation for the assassination 6 weeks ago or a major Hezbollah assault. The longer the Gaza crisis goes on, the greater the risks that there will be some further retaliation and the spiral of violence will continue.
So what could this UK government do? Because it seems very unlikely that it is going to in and of itself influence the Israeli government. Is it designed to influence European allies or even the United States, unlikely as that may seem?
I mean, what would influence the Israeli government is my question. Even President Biden, who piles billions of dollars of arms into Israel, doesn't have any significant leverage. So I think this is partly about showing that the government respect international law. But I think also it clears the way for them to work hard on a post-ceasefire arrangement. I think Western governments, if they can't influence Netanyahu, ought to be trying to get clear what will happen when a ceasefire eventually comes, which it will. Who will run Gaza? What will the security arrangements be? What security we can provide for Israel? I think those are issues where a British government should be working with European allies and with the Americans, having made this legal decision, which I think does send a signal about the government's commitment to international law.
Lord Ricketts, thank you.
Here's a 7:15. The temperature is really rising on this issue. Boris Johnson, the former Prime Minister, has just tweeted in the last few moments, why are Lammy and Starmer abandoning Israel? Do they want Hamas to win? We'll be talking to the Defence Secretary at 8:10. He may have a response to that and other criticisms. Now let's turn to the government's early prison release programme. In a week's time, 2,000 prisoners in jails in England and Wales will be released, much earlier than they or anyone else expected at the time they were sentenced. A few weeks later, another 1,700 serving longer sentences will also be released. It's a programme designed to free up prison places in a system so overcrowded there's simply no space for those the courts will convict in the weeks to come. It is the job of the probation service to manage those releases in a way that keeps the public safe. The chief inspector of probation described the early release programme as a roll of the dice, and he joins us now, Martin Jones. Good morning to you, Mr. Jones. Why a roll of the dice?
Well, I think it's important to be clear that the government, I think, faced no alternative other than to introduce this early release scheme, given the pressures on our prisons. But the probation service is equally under huge pressure. Now, there are no risk-free options in this particular area. It's important that the risk assessments are done. My judgment as Chief Inspector of Probation is that there's a huge amount of work going on to prepare for this early release scheme. But unfortunately, there is, of course, a risk that sometimes things will go wrong. The thing that I need to be clear about is that ultimately, I will make my judgment on how all those schemes work based on the evidence I see in the coming weeks and months. Again, I think given the huge pressure on the system with prisons at well over 99% capacity and probation probably in excess of 100% of capacity, I think this is a really challenging situation we face.
What about the capacity of the probation service to cope with all those prison releases? Because it's a huge spike, isn't it, in their workload?
That's right. I mean, if you look at the numbers, there are around about 50,000 people released from prison each year under the supervision of the probation service. So that's about 1,000 people a week. So when you get an additional 2,000, that's a huge increase in their workload. You need to ensure they have the accommodation to go to, that they've got the right drugs and health support in the community, but also that you understand the risk that they pose to communities. And getting that right, I think, has been really important. Now, the probation service said about 8 weeks. Now, that's far from ideal, but I do think it's given them a fighting chance to ensure that they've got a handle on the risk that those people pose. But the risk that you might see if the probation service can't cope or people's behaviour starts to deteriorate is that those people are then returned back to prison, which, of course, then exacerbates the pressure elsewhere. So it does require, I think, really urgent attention over the coming months with the new government.
Isn't the likelihood that we'll see more people reoffending who've been released and then they will have to be sent back? Because even under normal times, and these are clearly not at all normal times, there have been a series of cases, haven't there, of people going on to commit very, very serious offences.
Well, that's right. I mean, from time to time, as Chief Inspector, I'm asked to review serious further offences. Now, to put it into perspective, the probation service has something like 240,000 cases on its caseload. There are around about 300 serious further offences a year. Now, they're rare, but of course, every single one of those is a case too many. But that is really all about getting the risk assessment right to ensure you understand the risk, particularly, for example, around domestic abuse, which I think is a key area that's previously been picked up in our reports. But also around ensuring that you have the right staffing in place. And one of the things I think the probation service is currently really suffering from is a really chronic staffing shortage. It's really, I think, a question of fairness. You know, if people are suffering, you know, staffing vacancies as much as 40 to 50% in some areas, what is it realistic of those people to do? And in some areas, actually, maybe the choice will be to reduce the caseload to really focus on the most high-risk cases.
We, of course, hear the news of horrific cases of people who go on to murder after they've been released from prison. Try to put that in perspective. How many, what proportion of cases do you think are wrongly assessed by the probation service and end up reoffending?
So it's very difficult. I mean, it's probably around about 1 in 1,000 cases that they supervise ultimately end up in really tragic, serious offending. So it is incredibly rare. And probation good practice does keep communities safe. It's important to be clear about that. But it does need to ensure that the probation service has the resources in place to cope with those demands. And it's important to be clear, ultimately, you know, you are releasing people back into the community. They're not behind bars. You are managing them those under a tight license condition. So, for example, electronic tagging, monitoring perhaps their alcohol consumption, which again may be an increased risk factor, or ensuring there is mental health support in the community. And I do think we need to ask more from perhaps some of our local agencies to support the probation service in the work they're doing, particularly around, for example, health services and mental health, which we often identify as a gap.
Martin Jones, Chief Inspector of Probation, thank you for joining us.
20 past seven. We have just had the results of the government's latest renewable energy auction out, and Fliss has been looking through them. Fliss?
Yes, I have. Good morning. This is the auction where energy producers bid for what are known as contracts for difference. This means they agree a fixed price with the government for the energy they'll produce from certain projects. And the goal is that will produce stability for long-term projects. Now, in the last auction, you might remember, there were no bids for offshore wind contracts. And that's because energy producers said rising cost pressures meant the government minimum price was too low. This round, 9 contracts for offshore wind have been awarded, including what will be Europe's largest and second largest wind farm projects off the Yorkshire coast. I'm joined now by Keith Anderson, who's CEO of Scottish Power. Keith, good morning.
Good morning.
What will you be building as a result of today's auction?
So we have the rights to build in what's called the East Anglia zone. We've already built one project there. We're in the process of building a second, and that has now just won a contract to build a third project in that zone. So we're building another project of 1,000 megawatts, which is fantastic. And, you know, the results of this auction are really, really positive for the whole of the offshore sector. But more importantly, it's really, really positive to get the government back on track to delivering, you know, a net zero generation environment and electricity sector for the whole of the UK.
Because we had those troubles with the previous auction where the producers said the price wasn't high enough.
Yeah, that's correct. So there were increases in supply chain costs, so from producers, and that didn't make economic sense at the prices that were being offered. But, you know, the government have listened, they responded, they've created a very attractive auction. the developers have bid in. It's been a very successful process, and we're getting lots of megawatts coming out of it. And that puts the industry right back on track. It will allow investment into manufacturing in the UK. It allows the sector to get back up and running, and it puts the government back on track for hitting targets, really important targets, to decarbonise the sector.
There's a lot of concern, isn't there, among domestic customers about that 10% hike in the energy price cap coming in next month. What will these projects mean for them? Will their bills finally come down, or will they rise to pay for this technology?
So the more and more renewables we put on the system, then it will bring prices down. The most important thing is that we need to stop relying on volatile gas prices. And right now, unfortunately, those volatile gas prices still set and influence the price of electricity. But the more and more renewable energy we put on the system, the less and less the impact of gas. And then eventually we need to get to, and the government wants to do this by 2030, to a system that's dominated and the price is set by renewables, and therefore we have much more stability and we have lower electricity prices, and that will be good for the whole of the country.
Keith Anderson from Scottish Power, thank you very much.
Thank you.
23 minutes past 7. Nearly 80,000 people in England and Wales had smartphones snatched from them in the street. That's an increase of 150% according to government analysis of crime survey data. Figures out last year showed that nearly 70% of thefts in London were for mobile phones, 40% of robberies were for mobile phones. Well, there's now going to be a Home Office summit on this type of theft called Operation Opal to try and combat it. Let's talk to Jake Moore, Global Cyber Security Advisor at ESET, an internet security company, about what could be done. Good morning to you, Mr. Moore.
Good morning, Nick.
Is this about designing it out? Because in the past, we've often heard politicians say you can design out the problem. You can persuade the mobile phone companies to make it harder to use a stolen mobile phone.
Well, that would be fantastic if they could do that. And in fact, Google and Apple are trying their best to get rid of this problem. For example, Apple have got what's called stolen device protection, and that works by first recognizing the place that you frequent, like your home or your workplace. And when your device is taken away from these locations, extra security measures kick in before you're able to change the passcode. Because if someone sees you type in your passcode in, say, a crowded location, such as a festival, they are then able to get into further parts of that phone. And that's what thieves are after. So this is what Apple and Google are trying to do. However, as the secondhand market is so thriving, that means that we do have to have some features in place that enable you to completely factory restore the phone, enabling you to then sell it on to someone else completely random.
And as often or not, that resetting is actually happening out of the country, isn't it? In the past, my understanding was a lot of these mobile phones were kept in the capital before being resold, now often sent to China to be reprogrammed.
Yeah, so when phones get blacklisted in the UK by the network operator, once they have been stolen, they just can't be used in the UK anymore. So they look to work in other countries, and they do work in other countries. In fact, some of them have a habit of being sent to China due to this secondhand market of them. And if they can't get into these phones to use them again as phones, they're then used as parts, because the metals and the other parts inside these phones still have a huge value.
So you would require China's cooperation, would you, to deal with that particular part of the problem?
Well, looking into policing as we know it, using other countries to help out a big problem such as this can be very difficult and very resourceful heavy. So this is one of the big problems we have in many parts of, say, digital crime. But working with the fact this is digital crime and physical crime, it makes it that even much more hard to get round it.
Well, let's end with a tip. What would you say to people? Because I am struck by the fact that people often have £1,000 worth of goods in their hand, and they're paying almost no attention to whether it's secure. They're just sort of blissfully looking at their screen while carrying out what is in effect a vast amount of money.
Okay, well, Apple have got stolen device protection. You can set that on in your features. And Android has got what's called Android Theft Detection Lock, which is fantastic. But the best tip you can really take on here is to make sure your password is completely unique and nothing related to you, because some people can work that out. But on top of that, make sure your phone is always backed up.
Always backed up, right. Well, that doesn't stop it being stolen, though, does it? It just means that you can deal with it if it's stolen.
Yes, because sometimes, unfortunately, we can't get around the fact it might be stolen or lost, for example. But many people will be more worried about the data that's on there. So making sure you don't lose those lovely photos that you've got, if they're on the cloud, you can get them back.
Jake, can I ask you a quick question as well? I mean, I've heard of people who've had it stolen out of their hands, but then at knife point, they've been told to hand over their passwords.
Yeah, and this is one of the big growing problems. In fact, it doesn't just happen there. It can happen later on with threatening emails as well. And even if Google and Apple are to put, say, a secondary layer of protection on those devices, they can still come back with these threatening ways. And that's why they're looking at maybe disabling it completely. But of course, if that then happens, it then kills this second-hand market that we've got all over the world.
So, yes, so you could, in a sense, just say, as soon as it's stolen, it's gone, it's unusable, but then people who want a cheaper mobile phone aren't going to get one.
Absolutely, and so many of us are wanting to pass our phones on to our children as well, because we don't want to give our kids £1,500 phones, for example. Yeah. So it is a bit of a balance, and hence such a big problem we've got today.
I laugh because I think, like lots of parents, I have a drawer full of old mobile phones and occasional phone calls from one or other of the children saying, "Dad, I've lost the phone again." Jake Moore of ESET, thank you very much indeed.
Sport now with Simon.
Thank you. And Jack Draper is through to the quarterfinals of the US Open tennis, the first British man into the last eight in New York since Andy Murray in 2016. Draper delivered a statement straight sets victory over Thomas Mahatch. And next up, he'll face the 10th seed, Alex de Minaur from Australia. I spoke to our tennis correspondent, Russell Fuller, a short while ago about Draper's level.
He's played consistently very well over four rounds. He's yet to drop a set, but I think the crucial thing is, Simon, that he is ready to take this next step. Mm-hmm. He looks full of confidence. His serve is a very, very potent weapon at 6 foot 4 inches tall. And crucially, he now trusts his body. When he arrived at the US Open last year, he was still struggling with a shoulder problem, lots of physical problems in the rear window. But in the last 12 months, he's played consistently on tour, and that's gained the confidence that's enabled him to reach a first Grand Slam quarterfinal.
There is a bit of nice symmetry to British men's tennis. 20 years ago, Andy Murray announced himself by winning the boys' singles in New York just days after Tim Henman reached his sixth and final Grand Slam semi. And now Jack into the last eight, weeks after Andy Murray hung up his racket.
Yes, it's quite something, isn't it? And the relationship that Draper and Murray have is an important one. Andy Murray is not the sort of person to be offering lots and lots of advice if it's not requested, but they struck up quite a bond when Jack Draper was a junior, and then particularly when they were both on tour together. And Draper's very happy talking, as he was on court just the other day, about the fact that he misses Andy Murray and his stinking, rancid tennis shoes. So the advice that Murray is able to offer is vital, and also the example he set. As Draper said, if I can have half of the career of that man, I'm going to retire a very happy man.
Understandably so, with everything that Andy achieved. A very different player, though, isn't he, Jack, in many ways? For example, Murray's strength, you could argue, is his variety, his tennis IQ. But Jack Draper's got some serious firepower and weapons at his disposal.
And increasingly trying to use them. He had a growth spurt relatively late, and so for much of his junior years, he was trying to use his guile to outwit opponents, and then suddenly he shot up to 6 foot 4 inches. And it's been particularly this season where we've seen him take the decision to be more aggressive instead of trying to rally with players from the baseline. If I've got this height, if I've got this power, I need to be on the front foot more and dominate opponents.
And he's going to need to do that next up. Alex de Minaur, very tough match. He's had an excellent year, arguably the fastest player on tour. He'll make Jack play one more ball, and he owns their head-to-head so far.
Yes, the fact that Alex de Minaur has won all three matches and they've mostly been very close is an advantage for the Australian, and it suggests that there is something in the game styles that suits Alex de Minaur. because, as you say, he can run a lot. And he's got the experience of having been in three Grand Slam quarterfinals before Dimonor. But he is coming back from a nasty hip injury, which prevented him playing in the Wimbledon quarterfinal. He says he surprised himself at how well he's been playing and how well he's been moving. So Draper is definitely the underdog, but nice to be in a position now, having recorded four wins, where you feel like you've almost got nothing to lose.
Russell Fuller there. There were wins at Flushing Meadows too for the top seeds, Iga Świątek in the women's draw and Jannik Sinner in the men's. We'll be focusing on the Paralympic Games in an hour's time, and coming up shortly, Rose Ayling Ellis, the Games co-host.
Simon, thank you.
You know what happens when you open a can of worms?
On BBC iPlayer.
You murdered someone?
They released me.
He's done well for himself. Nice house.
How does all this make you feel?
Like he's gotten away with it.
Some things are better laid to rest. Dead and buried.
All the things he has that my brother never had.
He served a sentence.
Well, I keep serving mine.
Watch all episodes on BBC iPlayer.
And the weather. Today is going to see a mix of cloudy and sunny intervals, along with a few scattered showers, most of them easing in the evening.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Michelle Hussain and Nick Robinson at 28 minutes to 8. Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news.
The UK's chief rabbi, Ephraim Mervis, has said it beggars belief that the government has halted some arms exports to Israel. He says the move feeds the falsehood that Israel is violating international humanitarian law in Gaza. The former National Security Advisor, Lord Ricketts, told us the government's move was long overdue. A BBC investigation has found that the number of illegal Israeli settler outposts in the occupied West Bank has risen rapidly in recent years. There are currently at least 196 such outposts. 29 of them were set up last year. Documents seen by the BBC show that an organisation with close ties to the Israeli government has provided money and land used to establish some of the outposts. The Scottish Government is to announce significant cuts to public spending. The Finance Secretary, Shona Robertson, will say she's been left with no choice because of UK government cuts to Scotland's budget. The independent forecaster, the Scottish Fiscal Commission, has said much of the pressure comes from the Scottish Government's own decisions. The Cabinet Secretary, Simon Case, has said the last Conservative government's failure to hold a new spending review contributed to the current uncertainty about the public finances. Mr. Case made his remarks in a letter seen by the BBC, which he sent to the former Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, who'd written to him complaining about Labour's claim to have inherited a £22 billion black hole. Analysis by the BBC shows that councils across the UK have stopped running more than 180 libraries in the past 7 years. Dozens more could be shut as local authorities try to make savings. The government said it recognised the pressures public libraries faced, and it was committed to giving stability back to local councils. 5 seabirds have been added to the UK's red list of species at most risk. They're the Arctic tern, the giant skua, Leach's storm petrel, and 2 types of gull, the common gull and the great black-backed gull. Dawn Barmer from the British Trust for Ornithology told us their populations had declined severely because of factors including bird flu, overfishing and climate change.
Thank you, Caroline. 26 minutes to 8 now. Pride in Britain's history is at the lowest it's been since the war. Now, only 2/3 of the public say they're proud or very proud of British history. The figure was more than 80% for the past 3 decades. That is the findings of the British Social Attitudes Survey, a major annual poll of national attitudes. And it reveals that over the past 10 years, pride in our democracy and our economy have shrunk as well. To analyse what it all means to take the pulse of the nation, we are joined by none other than Professor Sir John Curtis, who is not just Master of Sophology and Election Guru, he is the Senior Research Fellow at the National Centre for Social Research, which carries out this big annual survey. Morning to you, John.
Good morning to you, Nick.
Are we able to say from this polling, not just that it is happening, this decline in pride in British history, but why it's happening?
Well, I think we certainly have to engage in a certain amount of interpretation, but I think the evidence that points to 2 things. One is that, in part, we're picking up the general zeitgeist that Britain is in a difficult place. So picked up the fact that we're less proud of our history, and we'll come back to that in a moment. But also marked declines in the last decade in the way that democracy works, our political influence in the world, achievements. And, you know, the same survey during the election campaign reported that our trust in politics and politicians was back low. And, you know, to that extent, at least, you know, we are, as a country, we know our economy has been struggling a bit. We've had a certain amount of instability. But it's not all been everything that's gone down, which suggests that indeed the circumstances of the time has made a difference. So, so far as our achievements in arts and literature are concerned, or indeed our sporting achievements, our levels of pride are almost pretty much back to still what they were.
So when it comes to history, John,
we do now take pride.
When it comes to history, there are two possible theses, aren't there? One is simply that the wartime generation is gradually dying out. There are fewer people with direct memories of service in the war. The other, promoted in the Daily Telegraph, for example, the whole series of academics say, no, the problem is we don't teach our young people to be proud of their history. In fact, if anything, we teach them the reverse.
Or alternatively, and I think this is the direction in which we would go, is that our history is now much more contested. One of the things, of course, that's happened during the course of the last 10 years is that we've got much more argument now about Britain's role in the slave trade and the legacy of that. What should our attitude towards the empire be? And it's certainly notable that the decline in pride in history is most evident amongst those people who have what the other chapter is also about, which is a relatively civic attitude towards British identity. People who basically say, look, you're British if you feel British, if you respect British laws and political institutions. It doesn't matter what your familial background is. People of that view, which is now the majority view in the UK and has become more obviously so, are the people who are least likely to be proud in our history. Those who say, look, to be British, familial background matters. Not only were you born here, but were your grandparents born here? Those are the people who still think we should be proud of our history. But the point is, our idea of what Britishness is has been changing over time. And that, at least, therefore, is one of the reasons why our history now is perhaps not necessarily something that we regard as something we should necessarily be proud of, or is certainly integral to what we are as a country.
If there is a divide, as you're describing, between people who think that Britishness relates to being born here and your parents and grandparents being born here, and they continue with pride, while other people, a growing number by the sounds of it, do not see things that way, what does that mean, John? And this is more about your analysis than the figures, I think. What does it mean for our politics?
Well, I mean, the truth is that I think there are two pictures you could have painted of Britain. One is as a country that, in leaving the European Union, was very concerned about its identity and its sovereignty, and that, you know, was in some senses reacting against some of the social changes that have happened. The other is of a country that, you know, despite the riots that we saw in the summer, is actually becoming more accepting of the fact that it is a diverse society with people with a variety of national backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, linguistic backgrounds, cultural backgrounds, religious backgrounds. And it does look as though, although, yes, there is a minority of us who still have that more ethnic conception of Britishness, is that the idea that basically to be British, it's a question of what you are willing to sign up to as an individual, not necessarily what your background was. That conception seems now to be with us. And if we are as a society going to integrate, if that's the right word, those who've come to this country from different backgrounds, and of course we've had a lot of that recently with high levels of immigration, then that the idea that Britishness is something that you can acquire and isn't something that you're only born with, in a sense, is important to us being able to maintain community relations.
John, Professor Sir John Curtis, thank you very much indeed.
20 to 8, let's have a look at the papers. And the main editorial in The Guardian this morning is about what we learnt yesterday on one-word inspection judgments, overall judgments on English schools being scrapped. We'll be speaking to the head of Ofsted just before 8 o'clock. And The Guardian says that this is entirely reasonable and the right thing to do, but asks a broader question, whether the proposed changes to the inspection regime go far enough and whether Ofsted, the watchdog, is resourced to do the new task required of it. Already schools have been told told they will have to contribute to teachers' pay out of existing budgets. It is not clear where an Ofsted budget rise will come from. The Guardian points out that England remains a highly centralised state in education and that the education secretary will retain her power to compel change at schools that would previously have been judged to be inadequate. However, Labour promises a boost to regional school improvement teams and more support for struggling schools, which is why The Guardian says the direction of travel is positive, away from Whitehall bossiness and towards a new restoration of autonomy for the sector.
Turning to the Telegraph's coverage, which I mentioned there, just talking to John Curtis of that poll, Professor Lawrence Goldman of St Peter's College, Oxford, said too much history teaching seems to start now from an assumption that the empire was inevitably malign. He is just one of the historians quoted there. Now, if you read Conservative supporting papers, you'll probably get more of a sense of the Conservative leadership race, which got going this week, really, in earnest, with a whole series of speeches being given in recent days. The Express leads on, brutally honest, Tories need to stop acting like Labour. That is a quote of Kemi Badenoch, and they seem to be rather impressed with what they heard. The Daily Mail seems to be more cautious about who it might back. Tory hopefuls make their pitch, it says on page two, quoting James Cleverly, the Shadow Home Secretary, saying, I'll revive Rwanda and ditch stamp duty, whereas Kemi Badenoch is rejecting any easy answer, her phrase, fix for migration. Other papers rather interested in the fact that the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, is vowing to take action on those huge rises, price rises, that people face when they were queuing to get Oasis tickets. Dynamic pricing, it's called. Other people call it a rip-off.
The Eye reports on a scandal that resulted in disappointed Harry Potter fans booing after an annual announcement at London's King's Cross did not happen. People gathered at the station on Sunday, hoping to hear a message on the PA system stating that the Hogwarts Express would depart from platform 9 3/4 at 11 a.m. as happens in J.K. Rowling's books. It is a Back to Hogwarts tradition, which celebrates the start of each academic year at Hogwarts School. But King's Cross did not mark the occasion on Sunday as it has in previous years, and which ended up that the expectant crowd then counted down to 11 a.m. and then booed when nothing happens. I don't think there is a response as yet from the station, so no one knows what happens.
I think a warning was given in one of the reports I read. A warning was given, don't go. I imagine they don't want all those people heading, but lots of people either didn't get the warning or frankly thought,
just hoped for...
Yeah, hoped it would be. But somebody changed their mind. It's now 17 minutes to 8. Drivers should pay a tax for every mile they drive. That's a call coming this morning from the Campaign for Better Transport. It's their answer to a big looming problem. The more we follow the government's advice to stop driving petrol and diesel cars and vans and drive electric vehicles instead to tackle climate change, the less money the Treasury is going to receive in petrol duty, which makes really rather an important contribution to the nation's coffers. Here is Sylvia Barrett, the campaign's Director of Policy and Campaigns.
We are proposing a 2p per kilometre charge, and we have done extensive polling which shows that petrol and diesel vehicle drivers think that it's only fair that EV drivers also should pay their fair share in taxation rather than leaving the Treasury looking at other ways to fund road investment, for example.
So the way it would work is this would be a tax to start with for electric vehicle drivers in order that they, as she puts it, pay their fair share. Well, what does a man who knows the industry incredibly well make of all that? Andy Palmer joins us now, familiar voice on the programme, former chief operating officer for Nissan, chief executive at Aston Martin, now chairs a number of companies that make parts for electric vehicles. Morning to you, Andy.
Good morning. How are you?
I think I've been having conversations about the possibility of road pricing for about 30 years. And any politician who gets remotely near it runs off like someone who scalded their hand on a pot. Because usually the reaction is very, very hostile. What do you make of this call?
Well, look, we clearly, as you said, the excise duty is a big part of our taxation system. And obviously, as you transition towards electric vehicles, which is an inevitability, the revenue you get from them will decline. So it's a problem that needs to be fixed. That I have no doubt. And over time, I've no doubt that we need to find a way of taxing electric vehicles.
And the technology is there, Andy, is it? I mean, given GPS
absolutely.
And so on, we could do it if we wanted to.
We could do it. Now, the question really is whether per mile is the right way to do it, because doing it on a per mile basis. It's already been trialed in Oregon, actually, in the US, and was deemed to be a failure. So I have some doubts about that as a methodology. I don't dismiss it, but I think there are other ways that one could look at it. The big problem with doing per mile, generally speaking, is that you use the GPS on the car. And that means that, if you will, the government knows exactly where you've traveled to. And it feels a little bit big brothery. There are other technologies that could be used. You could do it exactly the same way that you tax fuel. In other words, you tax electricity that's used on the car to charge the car. And the technology, of course, exists to do that. There are other ways. Norway is an interesting way that they look at the implementation of road tolls and higher registration fees for electric vehicles. I think my point ultimately is, let's not pioneer in this particular space. Other people have tried, have various mixed results, and I think we need to learn from other people's trials, not just necessarily go down our own route.
But change is coming, because the coffers have to be filled.
Change is inevitably coming, as they say, sure as tax and death.
Andy Palmer, thank you so much for joining us.
13 minutes to 8, time for Thought for the Day. And our speaker this morning is the Vicar of St Anne's in Kew, Giles Fraser. Morning.
Good morning to you. Lumpy came from Afghanistan, a street dog living off rubbish tips and begging for food from local houses. That's why she was called Lumpy, after Marx's concept of the lumpen proletariat, the beggars and thieves of the underclass. But Lumpy lucked out. Some journalists adopted her, and we adopted Lumpy from them. She started life in Kabul and ended up in Kew, quite the journey. She played with our children, she protected our house, she was our beautiful companion and friend, and yesterday we said goodbye to her. My son asked if we could have a funeral, and this sent me down something of a theological rabbit hole. What sort of funeral, if that's even the right word, would be appropriate for a dog? I wasn't sure, but in all innocence, my son wanted to say goodbye to a creature we all loved, and instinctively, it seemed absolutely right to honour that. So much of the Bible is focused on a specifically human drama. It starts with Adam and Eve, and for Christians, finds its denouement in the death and resurrection of Jesus. As St Paul puts it, "As in Adam all die, so in Christ shall all be made alive." At its core, this is the narrative from which the Christian funeral draws its meaning, and it deals with many specifically human concerns, our moral failures, our existential fear of death, our need for forgiveness. But none of this really makes much sense when applied to animals. That's why we don't baptise them or give them a Christian funeral. But there is another creation story before that of Adam and Eve, from the first chapter of Genesis, where human existence is set within a much wider cosmic narrative, and where we are created on the same day alongside the animals. This is where God breathes into creation, and, as it were, from where all creatures derive their breath. From this story, there is an alternative narrative arc in the Bible, in which both human and animal share together in the sacredness of life. For we too are creatures, yes, animals endowed with exceptional reason, but animals nonetheless. And of the many important theological things that have been drawn out by the climate emergency, one is that this crisis is now a fundamental question of salvation, and also that human life has to be regarded as more thoroughly embedded in the natural world, as sharing in this overarching concept of breath, of life, from the lumpen proletariat of the animal kingdom to the most brilliant and important of human beings. My son chose the hymn for yesterday's little funeral. Some think of this hymn as a bit twee. Personally, I think he chose rather well. All things bright and beautiful, all creatures great and small, all things wise and wonderful, the Lord God made them all.
That was Thought for the Day with Giles Fraser. It's now 10 to 8.
The suicide of headteacher Ruth Perry shone a light on a climate of fear and frustration around inspection, which had been building for years. That is part of the independent report that has been published today. It was commissioned after a coroner ruled that an inspection of Ruth Perry's school, which she knew was about to publicly state that it was going from outstanding to inadequate, contributed to her death. Ruth Perry had told her husband after the inspection that she thought the lead inspector was a bully and had come to school with an agenda. After her suicide, one parent at the school said his child had asked if all her teachers were going to die now. Well, Sir Martin Oliver is the man who commissioned Dame Christine Gilbert's independent report. He is now the chief inspector of Ofsted, which regulates schools in England. Good morning, Sir Martin.
Good morning.
First of all, do you accept this judgment that there was a climate of fear around inspections?
Well, I commissioned that report, as you said, and indeed I commissioned the Big Listen, which is a comprehensive survey, independent surveys, Ofsted own surveys, the largest ever in our history, which is a great moment now for us to rebuild, reduce pressure in the sectors in which we work, but to maintain those standards and to rebuild and reset a brighter future.
And in answer to my question, do you accept the judgment that there was a climate of fear around inspections?
Well, certainly. I was a head teacher myself, and you could certainly feel the pressure of inspections. And you know, the
that's
vast
not
majority-
the same as a climate of fear, is it? That's a very, very strong judgment that Dame Christine found.
She did, and I've accepted her report because, you know, holding schools to account, not just schools, your viewers or your listeners, sorry, will think about Ofsted inspecting schools, but we inspect and regulate early years and colleges, 92,000 settings across the country. And the important thing is that we hold those to account and that we do make sure that children get the best care and education in the system possible. But we need to do that in a way which is commensurate and allows staff to actually be the professionals working settings for the best of children. But where it is unacceptably low standard, we do have to call that out. That is the tough part of our job.
Yeah. And everyone will understand that it needs to be rigorous. That is the nature of a watchdog. But what we've learned from this report about the behaviour of the organisation, I appreciate that this is in the period before you were in charge of it, but to make no attempt to contact the family after this suicide or send a letter of condolence, to not inform the board, which is meant to hold the senior leadership to this account. The report says Ofsted assumed it had done nothing wrong.
So that's why I commissioned, along with my chair, this report. And so that report by Dame Christine Gilbert, we're very grateful for Dame Christine Gilbert undertaking this serious review into us. And alongside the Big Listen, that was the point. Let's make sure that we understand that we can build now a much better future and we can do far better for parents and children out there and give them more information about the settings in which we inspect and regulate.
Yes, and I understand that that's part of the future and what changes from now on. But now that we know these details about the attitude of Ofsted at this time, how can we see it as an organisation that was capable of making good judgments on schools when it made such bad judgments at this moment, which should have been a moment of crisis?
Well, again, I wasn't there, and so I can't talk about that, but I can look at Dame Christine Gilbert's review and, as I have, accept the findings which she made. That's why I commissioned that review. What I can do, though, is make sure that we focus on building a better future. And let's remember, we do thousands, tens of thousands of inspections, and the vast, vast majority of them go exceptionally well, and we get great feedback. And indeed, in some of the survey responses and in Dame Christine Gilbert's review, there are plenty of mentions about how things have improved, not just since I took over, but they've been improving since my predecessor made some changes. So we know that we can make a difference and we will continue to make a difference for children.
Have you spoken to Ruth Perry's family yourself?
Yes, I met them on my second day in office. It was the first meeting that I held back in January when I started.
And how did you feel after that, hearing from them directly?
Well, it was a shocking moment. Professor Waters is very courageous.
And, her sister?
Yes, that's Ruth's sister, and very courageous, and I was very grateful. And then Professor Waters has had other conversations with me. She's brought other head teachers in to see me and to meet me, and we've spoken and had exchanges. But the important thing now is that we make those changes. It's not just about listening, it's about action. I took action in January, and I recognise that Professor Waters said that they may have made a difference, and I hope that the changes I've made now will make a difference, but still make sure that we're giving parents the best information, we're raising standards, and children are getting the best education and care out there.
There is one aspect of Dame Christine's recommendations that you don't seem to have accepted in full, and that's about post-inspection surveys being administered administered to a through a third-party independent organisation. Why is that suitable?
Well, because it's an incredibly expensive exercise to do, and I need to place our very limited resources.
Okay. So if it was funded, you'd do it?
So if it was funded, it would be something that we would consider, but in the meantime, what we set out is a comprehensive response to that recommendation. We already have an independent body called ICASO, the Independent Complaints About Ofsted, that schools can go straight to and other providers. But we also have introduced panels where we bring trade unions, external representatives onto those panels. And there's an example in that report where we talk about four of them have happened already. And the people, the external bodies that have seen the way that we handle our complaints have been incredibly complimentary about the rigour and the consistency of our judgments. So we know that we do great work. Our inspectors are diligent, hardworking people. And let's remember, the vast majority of Ofsted's inspectors are out there working in schools alongside His Majesty's inspectors, our full-time employees. They're expert and they know what is a good school or a good provider.
Sir Martin Oliver, Chief Inspector of Ofsted, thank you.
It is 3 minutes to eight. Time for the weather. Here's Darren Bepp.
Thanks very much, Nick. Good morning. Let's start in Scotland, first of all, where we've seen temperatures as low as 4 or 5 degrees this morning. Many places still dry and sunny, but there is more cloud coming into the far west of Scotland. That will push its way eastwards through the day. It will bring with it a few showers, but maybe some late sunshine in western Scotland as that wet weather moves away. Temperatures in Scotland gradually getting up to 16 or 17 degrees, and we'll get the same temperatures, I think, in Northern Ireland, where it's a cloudy start this morning. Going to find some showers this morning. Those again will push eastwards, but we should see more sunshine and drier weather during the afternoon. And across England and Wales, well, the sun is coming out in the northwest of England, but there's a lot of cloud elsewhere for England and Wales. Got these showers or longer spells of rain through the Midlands and eastern England. That's slowly pushing its way eastwards. It will keep the risk of showers into the afternoon for East Anglia and the southeast, where it's still going to be quite muggy. Other parts of England and Wales should see some sunshine developing for a while as it becomes drier. Now, temperatures typically through the Midlands, 19, 20 degrees, similar across northeast England. Further west across England and Wales, temperatures will be a little bit lower, but towards East Anglia and the southeast, after that warm and muggy start, temperatures could get a little bit higher if we do see some sunshine. Now, the showers do become fewer overnight. It will turn quite chilly in eastern Scotland and northeast England. Lows of 5 or 6 here, otherwise 8 to 11 Celsius. Heading into tomorrow, there will be some sunshine at times, but we're going to see more showers breaking out through the day. And if anything, tomorrow may well be a little bit cooler than it's going to be today.
Darren, thank you very much. Tomorrow morning at 9, a new series of Number Crunching.
I'm Tim Harford, and on More or Less, we make sense of the numbers we hear in the news and in everyday life.
300 million tonnes of beef, even just in the UK.
Seems a lot, doesn't it?
We're here to answer your questions.
Is it true that the UK is growing faster than almost any other major economy?
And I've enlisted expert help to get us to the right answer.
This will surprise you as much as it did me, that actually most people don't spend quite that much every week.
These numbers do not add up.
The new series of More or Less, with me, Tim Harford, Wednesday mornings at 9 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
In the next hour, we'll be asking what the government's partial ban on arms sales to Israel adds up to. And the author of the Jet Reacher series, Lee Childs, tells us he wouldn't have written the books without a Birmingham library.
Reading, reading, reading for decades, that's what turns you into a writer. So no book would ever get published if it wasn't for reading early in your life.
You're listening to Today. It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 3rd of September. The headlines this morning: the chief rabbi who leads the biggest wing of Orthodox Judaism in the UK has said the government's decision to suspend some arms sales to Israel beggars belief. Scotland's finance secretary is expected to confirm hundreds of millions of pounds in cuts to public services. The head of the civil service has said the Conservatives' failure to conduct a spending review contributed to uncertainty about the public finances. And a survey of British attitudes suggests that national pride has dropped sharply. The BBC News is read by Caroline Nicholls.
The UK's chief rabbi, Sir Ephraim Mervis, has said it beggars belief that the British government has blocked some arms sales to Israel. The Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, told MPs yesterday that the UK was suspending around 30 of the existing 350 export licences. Zrefreim, who represents the biggest wing of Orthodox Judaism in the UK, warned that the government's actions fed the falsehood that Israel was breaching international humanitarian law. This morning, the former Prime Minister Boris Johnson has asked why Labour are abandoning Israel and whether they want Hamas to win. Our political correspondent, Harry Farley, reports.
The government's announcement is more significant politically than militarily. UK arms exports are relatively small, less than 1% of Israel's total weapons imports. But it matters both diplomatically and domestically on a sensitive issue for the Labour Party. The chief rabbi, Sir Ephraim Mervis, who criticised Labour under Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, said the announcement would serve to encourage Israel and the UK's shared enemies. He added the timing, coming as funerals were held for some of the hostages found dead on Saturday, beggared belief. The Conservatives' Shadow Foreign Secretary Andrew Mitchell said the announcement had the appearance of something designed to satisfy Labour's backbenchers. But some Labour MPs, as well as other opposition parties, have criticised the government for not going further. They want a total ban on arms exports to Israel. A spokesman for the government said it was legally obliged to suspend export licences for arms that could be used in the current conflict. But the UK remained committed to Israel's security.
A BBC investigation has found that the number of illegal Israeli settler outposts in the occupied West Bank has risen rapidly in recent years. Documents seen by the BBC also show that sanctioned settlers have been supported by an organisation funded by the Israeli government. Amir Nader reports.
The World Zionist Organisation's Settlement Division distributes land to Israelis in the occupied West Bank to use for farming, but forbids the building of any structures. Documents obtained by an Israeli NGO and analysed by the BBC show how the WZO repeatedly allocated land to settlers who then constructed illegal outposts on it. Two of these settlers were sanctioned by the UK earlier this year for violence or intimidation of Palestinians living near them. The WZO did not respond to our questions. New BBC analysis shows the number of illegal outposts has risen rapidly, with at least 196 across the West Bank. 29 were set up last year, more than in any previous year.
Scotland's Finance Secretary, Shona Robison, is expected to confirm today that she's making hundreds of millions of pounds in cuts to public services this financial year. The Scottish Government says its budget has been reduced by Westminster. The UK government has blamed incompetence by both the SNP and the previous Conservative administration in London. Here's our Scotland editor, James Cook.
Shona Robison says the UK is entering a new era of austerity, which will have a profound effect on the Scottish Government's ability to deliver services. The widespread cuts she will announce at Holyrood later come on top of measures already taken to reduce spending, including means-testing winter fuel payments, closing a fund for the arts, and ending some subsidised rail fares. The independent Scottish Fiscal Commission says much of the pressure on the budget comes from the SNP's own decisions, including freezing council tax and raising public sector pay. State-funded university tuition, prescriptions and welfare payments to poorer families are also expensive. But the Scottish Government says the root problem is that the UK is plagued by entrenched poverty and low growth, exacerbated by its departure from the European Union.
BBC News has seen a letter from the Cabinet Secretary Simon Case that suggests some actions taken by the Conservative government contributed to uncertainty about public spending. Mr. Case was replying to the former Chancellor Jeremy Hunt, who told him that Labour's claims to have inherited an economic black hole had brought the civil service into disrepute. Here's our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman.
When Rachel Reeves unveiled what she said was a shocking £22 billion spending gap in July, her predecessor as Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, was furious, not only attacking his political rival, but questioning why her figures differed from those signed off by civil servants just days before. In his private response to Mr. Hunt, leaked to the BBC, Simon Case, the Cabinet Secretary, said this mismatch was simply an inevitable result of the parliamentary timetable being warped by the sudden general election, and that the civil service had acted appropriately throughout. But then he went further, contending that sizeable in-year changes to spending plans in recent years were because of the last Conservative government's decision not to hold a new spending review, which would have updated departmental budgets at any point since 2021. Pointedly, he said that the new government had explained to Parliament the pressures that it is having to manage down, unlike previous years. An ally of Mr Hunt said they were unsurprised that the head of the civil service was supporting the current government's position. A spokesperson for the Cabinet Office said it did not comment on leaks.
131 clean energy projects have won government price contracts in the latest auction for renewables. The Department for Energy Security and Net Zero said the schemes would generate enough electricity to power 11 million homes. The details from our business editor, Simon Jack.
A total of 9.6 gigawatts of renewable projects have been awarded guaranteed electricity price contracts by the government. They're a combination of offshore, onshore and floating wind projects, as well as solar and tidal schemes. In total, it's the equivalent of three large nuclear power stations. This will go some way to make up for the failure of the last auction to attract a single bid for offshore wind, which is the backbone of the UK's future renewable plans. The industry complained then that the price offered for the energy they would produce was too low. The last government significantly raised the price for this auction, and the new Labour administration boosted the total amount they could bid for.
Two teenage boys have been charged with the murder of 13-year-old Josiah Coke, who was fatally stabbed at his home in Oldbury in the West Midlands on Thursday. A man in his 40s has been charged with assisting an offender. All three will appear before Birmingham magistrates later today. An independent review has found that Ofsted was defensive and complacent in its response to the suicide of the headteacher Ruth Perry. She took her own life in January last year after learning that the watchdog was downgrading her school. Ofsted's chief inspector, Sir Martin Oliver, has accepted most of the review's recommendations and told us his focus now was on building a better future for the organisation. Data gathered by the BBC shows that councils across the UK have stopped running more than 180 libraries in the past 7 years. More than 900 other libraries, almost a third of the total, have had their opening hours reduced. The government said it recognised the pressures public libraries faced and it was committed to giving stability back to local councils. The former children's laureate, Michael Rosen, said the figures are horrifying.
I just feel so sad and angry that this wonderful facility that we've had and perhaps taken for granted has been eroded. This seems to me to be like a decimation of our cultural entitlement. If you take away libraries, if you take away the hours that people have access to, you are hurting people. It's like an act of cruelty.
A report by a group of charities says the government should change the way it funds children's services. It says families in England are not getting the help they need before they reach crisis point. Here's our political correspondent, Hannah Miller.
The Children's Charities Coalition finds that more money is being spent on placing children in homes than on services to prevent them going into care. It says spending on early interventions has almost halved since 2010. The charities suggest this is likely to have played a part in the increase in the number of looked-after children. Ministers say their new Children's Wellbeing Bill will strengthen regulation to ensure every child has a safe, loving home. The charities are concerned this doesn't include funding increases for early interventions or wide-scale reforms.
A survey suggests there's been a sharp fall in national pride over the past decade. According to the National Centre for Social Research, the proportion of people saying they're proud of Britain's history has dropped from 86% to 64%. But there are indications that the country has become more inclusive in its attitudes. Our Home Editor Mark Easton has been looking at the figures.
The research suggests Britain is a nation redefining itself, questioning its politics, its past, and its relationship with the rest of the world. A decade ago, with intense debates about Brexit and immigration, the survey reported almost two-thirds of people saying they'd rather be a citizen of Britain than anywhere else. Now, only half agree with that statement. Pride in Britain's history has fallen dramatically amid arguments over the empire and slavery. In 2013, three-quarters of people agreed that being truly British meant being born in Britain. Now that's fallen to a little over half. What emerges is a country increasingly proud of its cultural diversity, of sporting and artistic achievements, but also challenging ideas of superiority or exceptionalism.
Mark Easton reporting.
Caroline, thank you. It's 8:10. Why are Lamy and Starmer abandoning Israel? Do they want Hamas to win? That's the provocative question posed this morning by the former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, posting on X, formerly known as Twitter. He's echoing criticism from the chief rabbi, who said the new government's decision to ban some arms deals to Israel beggars belief, and from Israeli ministers like Amichai Chikli, the Minister for Diaspora Affairs, who spoke last night on The World Tonight.
It's a disappointing decision.
in a very sensitive moment for us when we are burying six of our people who were murdered in Hamas tunnels. I think it sends the wrong message. I think we need to combat terrorism together. The fight against ISIS and Al-Qaeda and Hamas, it's the same war between the Western civilization and radical Islam. The threat that is coming from Hamas is also an inner threat that you are facing in the streets of UK.
But Israel's critics have been left just as frustrated by what is, after all, just a partial ban on arms sales, one which the Foreign Secretary told the House of Commons yesterday was not an embargo. Not, he said, a blanket ban, not a punishment of Israel. And he went on to say would not have a material effect on Israeli security. Amongst those frustrated, a woman elected as Labour MP for Coventry, but now not currently sitting with the party after being suspended for rebelling against the party whip, Zara Sultana.
While this decision appears to show that the UK has finally accepted the clear and overwhelming evidence of Israeli war crimes in Gaza, it is too limited and it is inconsistent. The UK government is suspending just 30 licenses out of 350. So if the government is admitting that British weapons might be involved in breaking international law, I don't understand how it can justify the remaining 320 licenses, including F-35 fighter jets that have been dropping 2,000 bombs on Palestinians for months. And these are described by their manufacturer as the most lethal fighter jets in the world.
In a moment, we'll get the Defence Secretary John Healey's reaction to those criticisms. First, let's go to our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, who is in Israel. This decision by the British government comes at an extraordinarily sensitive time in Israel, a time when the country appears to be more divided than ever.
Well, extraordinarily sensitive in the first place because yesterday was the day of some of the funerals for the six Israelis, including an Israeli-American, who came home to Israel in body bags. And that has provoked what it's a collective sorrow and sadness right across Israel. And it led to Israel's largest trade union, the Histadrut, to join forces with the families of the hostages who have been taking to the streets week after week for many, many months now, urging Prime Minister Netanyahu to prioritize the hostages ahead of his war aim to destroy Hamas. And so this is very, very much what is at the top of the minds of Israelis. So yesterday, the timing was very bad, but no day would have been a good day in a war which is now in Israel being cast by many, and certainly by Prime Minister Netanyahu and his supporters, as in a binary way, a for us or against us, that Israel says this is an existential battle and any criticism is something which supports Hamas. Not all Israelis see it that way, but that's how it's been cast officially, at least by Prime Minister Netanyahu.
Lise Doucette, thank you. And listening to that and joining us now is the Defence Secretary John Healey. Morning to you, Mr. Healey.
Good morning.
As I was saying in the introduction, you're facing criticism from both sides of this very divisive issue. Let's begin with what I described a moment ago as a provocative question from Boris Johnson, but it's one that I think you should hear and be given the chance to answer. Why, the former Prime Minister says in a post this morning, why are Lammy and Starmer abandoning Israel? Do they want Hamas to win?
This is a government with a duty to the rule of law. This is not a decision about pleasing any side in this. And when I spoke with the Israeli Defence Minister yesterday, I explained that we had a commitment to follow the rule of law, but I also made clear that the UK stands strong with Israel. That continues. And we are resolute in our determination to support their right to self-defense and their defense if they come under direct attack, just as we've done in the Red Sea when the Houthis directly attacked Israel, as well as Israeli-linked shipping and international shipping, and as the UK did back in April, when UK jets helped intercept Iranian missiles and drones directed at Israel and at Israeli citizens. And by doing so, we helped protect many civilian lives.
So were you saying as Defence Secretary, after those conversations that this decision won't actually have any material impact on Israel's ability to continue its war?
Well, the Foreign Secretary, as you reported before, said yesterday in the House of Commons that this won't have a material impact on Israel's security. That's not the purpose of the steps that he announced yesterday. What he said yesterday was, faced with a conflict such as this in Gaza, it's the government's legal duty to review export licenses. We said before the election that this is what we would do. He kicked that off soon after the election. So yesterday was the day, the first day back from MPs, that he could properly report to Parliament, which was the conclusion of that process.
Are you saying that explains the timing, Secretary of State? Because you will know that on a day that Israel was burying young Israeli hostages shot, we're told, by Hamas, that it was extraordinarily insensitive to announce that decision on that day.
We're in the middle of a bloody, brutal conflict. As Lise Doucette just said, no day is a good day. And yesterday was agonizing, even for us, seeing the pictures of those vibrant young people on the front pages of our newspapers that have been brutally murdered by Hamas just before they were released, and agonizing for their loved ones and their families that have been desperately wanting to see them back. But government does have a duty to the rule of law. The legal process on licenses have been concluded. Ministers had accepted those assessments. And so the timing was driven by the fact that Parliament returned yesterday. It was the first opportunity properly for the Foreign Secretary to report the conclusions of that review of export licenses.
You're not implying here, are you, Minister, that this really is all about you simply implementing what lawyers tell you? There's an old saying, isn't there? Advisors advise, ministers decide. And you have made a decision to continue with many arms sales to Israel. You've only stopped about a tenth of them. And you just heard Zahra Sultana and many other people listening to the programme will say, what more evidence do you need that British weapons are being used to kill thousands of people in Gaza and arguably many people in the West Bank as well?
Well, advisers advise and ministers decide certainly applies to policy. This is a legal process. It's a process that has been in place for some years. This is about respecting the rule of law and following that process that has been laid down. And
there's obviously discretion, though, isn't there? Because David Cameron pursued this process when he was Foreign Secretary and didn't come to this conclusion. David Lammy looked at this for some weeks and didn't instantly come to this conclusion. There's discretion for politicians. And what your critics are saying is that you're trying to have it both ways. You want to say that you're still on Israel's side while trying to appease Labour activists who were threatening to defeat ministers at the party conference because they're furious about what's happening in Gaza.
This is not about pleasing anybody. The UK absolutely, and as a government, we stand with Israel and determined to defend their right to self-defence and to support them in defending against any direct attacks. This is about the legal process that has identified around 30 UK-produced and exported components or parts of weaponry that in Gaza present a clear risk that international humanitarian law could be breached.
Well, what about the planes that bomb Gazans? What about the F-35s that bomb Gazans? There is no ban on the parts there. You're not suggesting, are you, that there is no risk of a breach of international humanitarian law after that mass bombing?
There's a carve-out for the F-35s for two reasons. Technically and legally, because the UK is the only producer and supplier of certain really critical components, and these go not directly to Israel or any other country, they would go into a global pool for repairing and maintaining aircraft. And you simply can't say which aircraft for which countries they will go to. There are over 20 countries that fly F-35s. There are around 1,000 F-35s around the world. And the second reason is, if we'd suspended all UK licences for F-35s, we would undermine a global supply chain that's absolutely vital for our UK security, the security of our allies, and also security of NATO.
And indeed, manufacturing jobs in this country, no doubt as well, which I suspect were on your mind. Talk of which, we've got a budget coming up. The Prime Minister yesterday said that we all had to prepare for difficult decisions ahead. Do you want to prepare people in the armed services for the fact there will be difficult decisions announced in the next few weeks? Perhaps the cancellation of some big defence projects that can no longer be afforded?
Well, across government, we're now all dealing with public finances this year that are far worse than we or anyone else thought before the election. This is probably the worst inheritance of any government in living memory. So that's why both the Prime Minister and the Chancellor have talked about tough choices, choices that we would not want to make or have expected to make.
Which will include defence.
Including on defence, that we will make because we have to get a grip of the public finances. We have to see growth back in the economy, and that's the way that we can rebuild both the wealth of this country, yeah, as well as the public services.
But obviously you can't tell us which yet, but some defence projects are going to have to be cancelled to make the books add up.
So we will do our part to help this government deal with the deficit this year and the dreadful state of the public finances.
I think that's a yes. So let's move on. There's another story we've been talking about today, which I know you'll be interested in. Professor Sir John Curtis was on the programme half an hour or so ago, pointing out a major national poll, the British Social Attitude Survey, saying that pride in Britain's history has fallen substantially. Having been above 80% for the past three decades, in the last 10 years, it has dropped to about two-thirds. 64% is the figure. Do you regret that? And is it part of this new government's job to restore pride in Britain's history?
Yes and yes. Yes, I regret it. Yes, I think it is part of our government responsibility to point to help people see the things that we should all be proud of. It's very hard not to feel proud of this country when you're sitting in the basement of the military headquarters at the Ministry of Defence. It's very hard not to feel pride, as I did when I was on Saturday morning at 5 o'clock, boarded a returning nuclear submarine in the mouth of the Clyde, and to talk to those submariners that had been returning from patrol 24/7, 365 days a year, helping keep us all safe.
Defence Secretary John Healey, thank you for joining us.
It is now 23 minutes past 8. A food bank for the brain is how the writer Lee Child, who is the creator of the character Jack Reacher, which has led not only to books but films, and who is a man who has sold 100 million books, has described his childhood library in Perry Bar in Birmingham to us. He spoke from the US early this morning after news that the place he knew and loved as a child is one of four Birmingham libraries slated for closure under plans proposed by the City Council. Others will open for a reduced number of hours. I asked Lee Child to take us back to his childhood in Birmingham and when he first went to the library in Tower Hill and what it meant to him.
I do, absolutely. We started out at our local library in Handsworth Wood where we lived, which was tiny. It was just in a little hut, a sort of post-war survival. Somebody put it in a wooden hut and it didn't have very many books at all. And I'd read them all by the time I was six. And I thought, okay, that's it. You know, I've read all the books now. But then I heard that there's another library. You know, there's more than one. And it was a epic trip. It was quite a long walk. And then it was like something out of the Lord of the Rings. We crossed this incredibly scary high footbridge over the canal and then turned a corner. And there it was, this immense glass-fronted palace just full of books. I couldn't believe it. And I went there at least once a week before I left for university.
And was this the Perry Bar Library, which is now at risk of closure under these new proposals?
It is. And they got in touch with me a while ago to tell me about it. And I saw the coverage. And of course, it's not a huge glass-fronted palace. It's a perfectly normal-sized place. So that was just my kid's impression. But what I do remember, I'm so sentimental about it and so emotional about it, because that building saved my life at the time. It enabled it. It largely created it. I just read and read and read and was lost in every subject, anywhere in the world, any time of history. I just adored it. And now it's under threat. And I completely understand, first of all, Birmingham's financial problems due to underfunding, and then this mistake that has come back to haunt them with the financial penalty they had to pay. I understand they got no money. And I understand that my experience was more than 60 years ago when the world was totally different. I mean, you and I would be talking on the home service back then, not Radio 4. And so people are going to say, yeah, that was then, this is now. What's the connection? Well, the connection is certainly, yes, information and entertainment has been totally changed because of the digital world. But fundamentally, if you take a step back, what was that library providing to the community? It was providing a refuge, a resource, a place that kids like me could go and feel like they were fitting in. But also adults, they would go. They were taking qualifications for jobs or night school or whatever. They would use it too. Everybody used it. The hardest thing in politics, I think, is to say, I don't know. What is the role of libraries going to be in the future? The honest truth is we don't know. But it's going to be something, something really important. So I feel like if you've got to cut costs somewhere, that's a very sad thing. But don't cut them from libraries, because you are amputating a huge future for a lot of people.
Can you say, Lee, that Jack Reacher wouldn't have happened had it not been for Perry Barr Library?
Absolutely. And you speak to any writer, they'll tell you the same thing, that those early years of reading for decades, that's what turns you into a writer. So no book would ever get published if it wasn't for reading early in your life. And the way things were, you know, my parents were lovely people and would buy us books if they could afford it. But that was twice a year, at your birthday and Christmas. And so if you wanted to read anything else ever, you had to go to the library.
And was it also a space for you? It was later on, was it a space that you lingered in, or was it always a space that you went to and you found a new book and you discovered that there was no end to the books out there?
That's what I loved about it, the endless choice. And I wasn't one of those guys that sat in the library to read. I would go in, select the books, and officially you were only allowed two books a week. But we operated a kind of Chicago voting system in our house that if anybody ever visited, you know, grandparents, uncles, whatever, we made them sign up for a library card. And our dog even had a library card so that we could get like six each a week. And it was fantastic.
You gamed the system.
Yeah. I mean, why not?
But then how do you feel knowing about this? Because what you're describing, what it gave you, yes, times have changed, but human needs remain the same. Indeed, society's needs, because we need the writers of the future. We need the Lee Childs and characters like Jack Reacher of the future.
We do, but it's not just writers. You know, it's obviously very linear. I read some books, now I write some books, but dozens of my friends would go with me who are not writers. One of them ended up an engineer on the London Underground. Another one was a doctor. You know, it grows children. It allows them to find what they're interested in, check it out for years, and then make a decision about interests and careers later.
Do you think people like you could step in, people who were part of the community or are part of the community, and save this?
I think yes. I mean, I help out wherever I can financially with any issue, but it's too big for any one individual or any group of individuals. This has to be a policy that is valued centrally and promoted centrally and funded centrally. It's too big for donations. I hope people are going to do what they can in the short term, but the long term has got to be a funding solution. And libraries should be very near the top of the list.
Lee Child, thank you very much. That takes us to the sport now, which is with Simon Mundy.
Jack Draper has announced himself as a Grand Slam contender after demolishing Thomas Mahatch on the way to reaching the quarterfinals of the US Open tennis for the first time. He's also the first British man into the last eight in New York since his friend and mentor Andy Murray in 2016. And next up, he'll face 10th seed Alex de Minaur tomorrow. At the Paralympics in Paris, there were six gold medals for Paralympics GB on day five. Among the highlights, archers Nathan McQueen and Jody McQueen claimed gold in the mixed team compound open final. It was McQueen's second medal after she won women's individual compound bronze on Saturday. Now, Jody is 7 months pregnant too. I spoke to her a few minutes ago and she said winning gold reminded her of being like a kid at Christmas.
Children look forward to Christmas. It's the one time where they feel like they can get anything they want. It's not as easy for Christmas. You can't just put it on a list. You've got to put the hours and the time in. And I know I've done that. So to actually have the relief of it paying off was just exceptional.
And I know you wanted to jump up and down in celebration, but being 7 months pregnant decided that probably wasn't the best idea.
No, exactly. So, you know, and as much as I did want to jump around and dance and everything else, at that moment, it was better to just take a knee for a second, lean over Nate, have a cuddle, you know, try and hold those tears back and just breathe.
Very sensible. Now, your build-up to both of your medal matches hasn't been straightforward, has it? You've been in and out of hospital for checkups, and yet you've really retained your focus and your composure brilliantly.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, no, the baby hasn't wanted to play very well this week, but thankfully, you know, I've got an amazing medical staff. I've, you know, got the British Paralympic Association that have been fantastic, making sure that I've got people that I need. You know, my manager and my coach have made sure that everything is sorted and stress-free as much as it can possibly be. So, you know, the aim is that I will compete as long as it is safe and, you know, the baby stays healthy and I stay healthy. And then, you know, we're going to get me home today, which is going to be lovely as well, because I had a job to do. I've come out, I've done it. And now I get to go home and celebrate with my family and just have a little check with my midwife tomorrow.
Absolutely. Job done. And you are the first openly pregnant woman to compete in the Paralympic Games. And I know you've really received worldwide attention. How's that been?
Do you know what? I was a bit shocked by it, to be honest, because, you know, it wasn't like I've done it for the attention. It wasn't like I've done it to be like, oh, I think this would be great as a first. So the fact that it's something that has escalated to this level is just incredible. And if it can inspire people out there to make the same decision or even just show that it's possible is one thing, you know. And I always said that I'm not coming to these games, you know, to participate. I'm coming to compete. I'm coming to win, pregnant or not. So to add that to it is just been absolutely fantastic.
And I know your baby hasn't stopped kicking, but you trained in such a way as to stimulate that sensation. And obviously it paid off.
Oh, 100%. You know, my coach, Charlotte, you know, she is a mum. She is an Olympian. She 100% knows the hard work that goes into both. She also knows the feeling behind, you know, having a bump and the baby's movements and how unpredictable, but also how massive they can be. And in a sport where it is about stillness and being calm and aim, that is something that you can't just predict. So she's made sure that we've done little pregnancy prep sessions, and at full draw under pressure she'll be like moving the bump in certain ways and, you know, applying certain movements to simulate that baby movement. You know, she was absolutely spot on with it and fantastic.
Jody Grinham, congratulations to you and to Nathan McQueen too, and thanks very much for speaking to the Today programme.
Oh, no, thank you so much for having me.
Among the highlights for Paralympics GB today are medal contenders Ellie Challis and Tully Kearney in the swimming pool, and in the para-equestrian, Natasha Baker goes for her seventh Paralympic gold when she competes in the Grade 3 individual dressage event this morning. That starts in around 26 minutes' time at 9 a.m.
Simon, thank you very much indeed. About half an hour's time, the Life Scientific comes along and Jim Al-Khalili can tell us more.
Hello. Stand-up comedy can be a serious business if it's used to convey the wonders of science. Yes, this is the Life Scientific, not the Infinite Monkey Cage. And stand-up is just one of the strings to the bow of my guest today. As well as pioneering the use of nanoscience to deliver drugs within the body more effectively, Professor Ijoma Uchebu tells me about her remarkable life, from being fostered by a white family in rural Kent while her Nigerian parents finished their studies, to struggling to pay the bills through her PhD as a single mum with three kids. That's the Life Scientific. After the news at 9, or catch up on BBC Sounds.
The weather, a mix of cloudy and sunny intervals today, along with a few scattered showers. Most will ease in the evening.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Michelle Hussain and Nick Robinson. At 25 to 9, Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news.
The chief rabbi has condemned the UK government's decision to suspend some arms exports to Israel. Zephraim Mervis says the announcement will encourage what he called our shared enemies. The Defence Secretary John Healey told us the government had taken the decision because of its duty to uphold international law, but the UK continued to support Israel's right to self-defence. Scotland's Finance Secretary Shona Robison is expected to announce hundreds of millions of pounds in cuts to public spending for the current financial year. The Scottish Government says its budget has been reduced by Westminster. The SNP's critics accuse it of incompetence. BBC News has seen a letter from the Cabinet Secretary Simon Case that suggests some actions taken by the Conservative government contributed to uncertainty about public spending. Mr. Case was replying to the former Chancellor Jeremy Hunt, who'd told him that Labour's claims to have inherited an economic black hole had brought the civil service into disrepute. The government says it's secured a record 131 new clean energy projects in its auction of guaranteed electricity price contracts. They include what will be Europe's largest and second largest wind farm projects, Hornsea 3 and Hornsea 4, off the Yorkshire coast.
Thank you very much, Caroline. Let's talk more about that now, because it is news that has come in this morning of that latest renewable energy auction. 131 new projects. They include solar farms, wind farms on and offshore, and also tidal power. The government increased the amount of funding available from what was the case in the last auction. And essentially, this process is all about giving developers a guaranteed price per unit for the electricity they generate. Greenpeace UK says the auction has secured only half the offshore wind capacity needed for the UK to meet its green energy targets. Simon's on the line. Simon Jack, business editor, who's been following all of this. What do you make of the outcome, Simon?
I think this will be greeted with jubilation in the Department for Energy Net Zero. This time last year, when we had an auction, they failed to attract a single bid for any offshore wind, which is the backbone of Britain's renewable plans, because the government had set the price guarantee too low. The hurdle rate under which you have to get below, this auction works in reverse, cheapest wins, was too high. Now, the government, to its credit, did realise it had made a mistake and so boosted the hurdle rate under which you need to get for this one. And the current government boosted the kitty, the budget available for the project. So having got nothing last time, they got plenty of offshore wind here. And so it will be treated, I think, as a success. However, that doesn't mean that there aren't some problems ahead, which are, how are you going to connect all of these projects to the grid to get the power from where it's produced, largely offshore, onshore, and then across to the towns and cities across England? And that will be, I think, a very big test of Labour's new planning regime. A lot of people will say they don't want pylons, and there'll be tens, maybe hundreds of miles of them traipsing across rural England. So, but it, also this auction will be looked at, I think, with some, if it's looked on with jubilation in the renewable sector, there'll be great anxiety in the oil and gas sector, for which we still rely for over 70% of all our total energy needs. They say that the government plans to hike windfall taxes and critically reduce investment allowances, risks sending that industry into premature and accelerated decline, which will cost jobs and tax revenue. Putting the taxes up may cost tax revenue in the long run. So two sides to the overall energy picture.
What is the answer to the pylons question? Because underground infrastructure is more expensive, is it? And difficult, and yet we are going to need to, the ambition is to decarbonise the grid by 2035.
Yeah. So the Labour plan actually is to do it by 2030, which a lot of people think is ambitious at best and probably unrealistic. It is going to be a big thorny issue. Putting stuff underground costs somewhere between double and four times as much as putting them in overhead pylons. You're also going to need thousands of miles of subsea cables, and they have to come ashore at some point. And there's a lot of lobbying groups who are spoiling for this fight. This is going to come along. And as I say, a big test for Labour's attempt to sort of defeat NIMBYism in its ability to unlock economic growth, jobs, clean energy, and economic growth. So the projects are in the pipeline. Can they get the energy from where it's produced to where it's actually needed?
Simon, thank you very much.
It is now 20 to 9.
Let us turn to the Paralympics, where Rose Ailing Ellis, actor and Strictly Come Dancing champion, is one of Channel 4's presenters. She has become the first deaf presenter to host live coverage of the Paralympic Games. She's been working for Channel 4 alongside Claire Balding. And halfway through these games, it is clear just how good they have been for Paralympics GB. Yesterday, there were another 6 gold medals, which means second place on the medals table, 29 golds, 15 silvers and 10 bronzes. I spoke to Rose a short time ago and I started by asking her what the experience of presenting the coverage had been like.
You know what? It's been such a big challenge and such a big learning experience. It obviously is something that's never been done before. So it is also quite exhausting. I actually am quite tired, but it is such a great experience. And I feel like we are breaking a new ground or new bower, something like that. Yeah.
You really are. But tell me about the logistics, though, and how you're overcoming those challenges, because you're doing this interview by lip reading and with the help of an interpreter. But when you're working on live sport, as you are with Claire Balding in that Channel 4 show, how do you do it?
It's just a different way of communication. And I think a lot of people are thinking that is one way that we have to do it. But actually, there's many other ways that we can do it. So the way that we did it, I have my team of interpreter and Kirsty, the person that wear my earpiece, off the camera, and she will tell me what Grace in Wales was saying, our director. But then we also got an interpreter on a sofa swapped over. They're like my everyday interpreter, really. That's how it works. But Kirsty, her role is quite new. And we also got a flashball on the table. And the flashball will be a quick information that's writing on there. Mm. And sometimes it flashes different colours to me. And a different colour means different things. So orange would mean read your audio cue. Blue would mean talk over the picture. And red means emergency, do not talk anymore.
I'd find that quite useful myself, I think. Did you work all of this out in advance, or has some of it evolved while you've been on air, because we're now halfway through the games?
No, we did have 3 days of rehearsal before I came onto this job. But the day before we started our first live, with Claire, first time working with me, that was really fun, because I think with Claire, she actually starting to need the flashball herself. Sometimes she quickly asks questions and then the answer come up on a flashball. So actually, it's something that hearing people can take on too.
And then what you couldn't have predicted when you started the job was just how amazing the games were going to be for Paralympics GB. What has it been like to be there in Paris and to experience those moments?
I think it's absolutely amazing. I'm really lucky to get to be at the swimming pool every day. The swimming pool is doing really, really well. Altogether, they have won 13 gold. The amount of gold that we're getting this year, I can't keep up with it. Every time I come in the studio, it's like, oh, we've got 10 more now. I'm like, what?
And your favourite moments that you've seen?
My latest favourite moment is probably when Louise Biddy have won her goal and her reaction. She really didn't expect it. No one expects it. Really, my favourite moment is just seeing their reaction to their goal.
And do you feel that just as the Paralympians make people think, people in this country, others who watch them, just think about what's possible and admire their courage and their determination, do you feel that you are on the same path, that what you are doing is also a part of that and helps to change attitudes?
Yes, I think that's what the beauty of the Paralympian is, that every country it goes to, it changes the social awareness in that country in particular. Like if you look at Brazil and also in China when they were playing BG, and in London as well in 2012 it changed. And I think it's slowly changing still, because we're trying to move away from that hero and being brave. And like, the Paralympian are not there to make anyone feel better about themselves. It's just there to show their real high quality skill in sportsmanship, because not all disabled people can do what the Paralympian can do.
Rose Ailing Ellis, enjoy the rest of the games. Thanks so much for talking to us from Paris.
Not everybody can do what Rose does. broadcasting either. Extraordinary that she does that in the way she does. It's 9:15 now. More money is being spent on placing children in homes than on services designed to prevent them going into care in the first place. That, says a coalition of children's charities, is one reason why the number of children in residential care in England has more than doubled over the past 12 years. We can talk now to one of the signatories of that report, the chief executive of Barnardo's, Lynn Perry. Morning to you.
Good morning.
Your report talks of a vicious circle. Just describe that for us.
Yeah, indeed. This report demonstrates that for the first time, spend is now greater on residential care placements than it is on all early intervention services that would support children and families and potentially prevent some children entering care. The issue with that principally is that it demonstrates that many children and young people and families are not getting the right support at the right time. And that's because local authorities are having to make very difficult decisions about where to put their resources to meet their statutory needs for children in care at the expense of investment in early intervention.
So you're calling on the Chancellor and the budget to increase spending on this, are you? Just at the time the Prime Minister seems to be warning everybody of what he calls difficult choices in that budget.
The current situation is unsustainable, and what we've seen is an increase in the numbers of children and young people who are coming into care across the UK. What we're also seeing is a change in the population of children who are coming into care. So we're seeing older children who are coming into care later. What that often means is that they have quite entrenched unmet needs, which are more complex for local authorities to address in the time that children are in care. What it also means is that residential placements for those children are often more expensive. And that's not a sustainable situation financially. So there is both a fiscal case here to swing the pendulum back to greater investment in early help and support for families.
Prevention
as well
rather than cure.
As a moral case.
Mm, prevention rather than cure. Now, you're also Absolutely. Calling on the government to do something that it has so far resisted doing, which is to lift that two-child benefit cap. Why, given the tough choices that it currently faces, or at least says it faces, would it be right for ministers to take that decision, given the cost?
Well, research demonstrates that that is one of the main drivers of child poverty. We have 4.3 million children in poverty here in the UK, 1 million of them in destitution where their needs are not being effectively met at a very basic level. As one of the main drivers to lift that two-child cap, we could immediately lift almost 500,000 children out of poverty. There are some encouraging indications from government. The extension.
Oh, we seem to have lost Lynn Perry's line, but we've got
one of the household support.
We lost you briefly there, Lynn.
Just this week.
Forgive also, me, we lost you. We lost your line when you're in mid sentence.
Schools commitments to investments, but that one action would lift a very significant number of children out of poverty immediately and alleviate a lot of pressure in families. 60% of those families are in work, and it is a very, very challenging situation as we head into winter and fuel prices increasing, food yet to come down at a rate that makes things affordable for families. And we think that is one of the key things that would alleviate the struggle for some of those families that we work with here.
Okay. Lynn Perry, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Barnardo's. We did get them real sense of what you were saying, but sadly the line dropped out briefly there.
The time is now 11 minutes to 9.
That you may recognise is the sound of Mussorgsky. It's the sound you'll hear in a new play telling the story of the art of protest, the story of a virtuoso pianist who dared to challenge Joseph Stalin, the story of a woman who still has the capacity to inspire. She is Maria Udina. She's played by Stockard Channing at the Theatre Royal Windsor. And it, the play, is The Gates of Kiev, written by the playwright and actor Ian Kelly, who joins us in the studio. Morning to you. Welcome.
Great pleasure to be here.
Now, tell us why that story still has the power to inspire.
I first came across this story working as an actor and writer in Russia through a Russian film director who spoke of her as this sort of secular saint of protest in the arts. And it came back to me years later through this this wonderful charity called Bemuse, founded by George Fenton, the composer, and Oksana Simons, around the business of supporting young classical musicians, but also finding other audiences for the classical canon and ways to be theatrical with music. And it was first of all that, working with a pianist about telling a story of a pianist.
Well, what is striking about this play is it's not just a play, is it? It's a musical performance. But before you tell me more about that, her story, she played for audiences in Soviet Russia, but she also had a way of protesting too.
Yes, constantly. She had this sort of fearless maverick quality about her, possibly because she'd survived almost like a near-death experience as a teenager, a crippling arthritis in her hands, and survived it. This kind of fearlessness seemingly allowed her to publicly defy the authorities. Impressively, she interrupted her live radio broadcasts in order to protest against the regime, quote the works of Boris Pasternak, who was banned at the time. So she has this, if you will, sort of maverick, sort of, Vivian Westwood quality about not really caring, and out of that being able to, you know, change the world a bit.
People who've seen that great film, the comedy, The Death of Stalin, will remember the scene at the top in which there's a re-recording of a piece of music that is required by Stalin, and she's involved in that story.
Well, wonderfully, that story of her being obliged to re-record Mozart's 23rd Piano Concerto because Stalin had heard the live radio broadcast and insisted upon a recording, and there wasn't one because she was a band artist, so supposedly everybody was kept all night to record a record, almost certainly not true. The wonderful thing about some of the dazzling people in the arts is that actually some of the myths around them are almost more interesting than the truth of the story. A lot of the truth is there elsewhere, but it was her great friend Dmitri Shostakovich who actually was the origins of some of these myths around her. And the play is a lot about their relationship.
And we've talked about the music, and that is one of the things that we'll see beyond the great acting that we'll get from Stockard Channing, no doubt, is beautiful music.
Yes, it is a hybrid of a live piano concert. An extraordinary Russian pianist based in Italy called Gala Chestokova, who helped me in the writing of this play, but she's there on stage recreating the repertoire of this extraordinary pianist from the mid-20th century. But also, it should be said, it's a dance piece too. It features Zander Parish, who was one of the great dancers at the Mariinsky, the Kirov, but left because of the war, more recently, British originally, in his first acting, dancing role. So it's a piece about the live arts with live art.
And a final thought, is it a reminder, perhaps to people like me who do endless interviews about news events, that art, the arts, play a crucial role in world events, in protest, in people's ability to speak out?
Yeah, it's what links us. She quotes Putin that, you know, only beauty connects. She quotes similarly that, you know, Russia is not its czars, it's its art. And actually, the most important thing sometimes in troubled times is to go back to that classical idea.
Ian Kelly, thank you very much indeed. Good luck with the new play. It's The Gates of Kiev. It runs at Theatre Royal Windsor September the 4th until September the 14th. And if any West End producer is listening, you no doubt can put it on the West End too.
Prior to West End.
It is 6 minutes to nine. Never mind, I'll find someone like you. Well, it's a pretty distinctive and unmistakable sound, Adele's music. As for hearing and seeing her perform live, or perhaps even new music from her, it seems that that will not happen for an incredibly long time. Those were her words to an audience in Munich over the weekend. She'd already spoken of taking a big break, and she has a final live show coming up in Las Vegas towards the end of November. What kind of a gap will she leave as she appears less frequently or disappears for we don't know how long. Stuart Worden is the principal of the Brit School, the performing arts school which Adele attended. And Professor Kirsty Fairclough also joins us. She's the co-editor of a book called Diva: Feminism and Fierceness from Pop to Hip Hop. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Kirsty Fairclough, how firmly does Adele fit into that diva category, would you say?
Oh, she absolutely fits right into the notion of the diva, in terms of the, you know, otherworldly voice, the look, the hair, the behaviour, absolutely fits right into what we think of when we hear about the pop diva, although I think the term is much more complex than we might initially think.
Yes, I mean, on behaviour side, it's often viewed quite negatively, isn't it?
It is, but it's kind of pejorative. It's also positive. It's kind of neutral as well. I think it's been used in lots of very differing ways over the last couple of decades, for sure.
Yeah, and it carries that sense of glamour with it, which, of course, is very much part of her persona. Stuart, I think she was at the Brit School before your time, but what do people say about her and what she was like in that period?
No, she was. I taught Adele. And, well, I didn't teach Adele. I worked with Adele, so she
What's
was there
the
when I was a teacher here. I think. Well, I'm a theatre teacher, but we used to talk about music in the foyer a lot, and about her love of Billie Holiday and Ella Fitzgerald, Etta James. So yeah, that's how I know her. And then obviously it's been an absolute joy to see her develop from a young songwriter here to being the sort of phenomenon she is now.
So how much of how we see her now do you recognise from how she was as a teenager?
I think, yeah, the same person, really. I love the fact how she was always fiercely hardworking here. She was always really knew who she was. She really believed in the song, so she studied songs. And she studied them in detail. So the song was everything to her. And I think that's been shown by her songwriting over time. And that that kind of delivery as a girl from London was here, is still present. Yeah. So I really recognise her.
That's so interesting about how essentially she would deconstruct a song and really think about what works.
She just really loved songwriting and really believed in the song, and I think that's shown through the quality of her songwriting over time, that she really studied songs like a student would, you know, like a student of songwriting would.
The voice itself, she's still only 36, but wow. I mean, that voice has got to have developed. It's such a big voice. Did she have it as a teenager?
Yeah, that voice, of course, it's grown because she's worked and worked and worked on that technique. That's why I think her longevity is there for all to see and admire, really. But yeah, she had, you can tell on 19, which she wrote some of those songs while she was a student here and performed them here, and, you know, in scratch performances. And it's just a beauty to see them, those early days. And that voice was there, but of course it's grown as she's worked on her technique, because she's cared about improving time and time again.
Kirsty, how does she fit into the panoply of other divas? I mean, I'm thinking back to Aretha Franklin, Whitney Houston, Celine Dion, who's just come back. We haven't had many British women who are in that category.
No, that's true. I think, yes, Adele fits directly into the notion of the pop diva. But I think, you know, as I said, it's kind of evolved over the last couple of decades. And obviously it originally derived from the opera world to describe exceptional female singers with those exceptionally powerful voices. It's definitely taken on broader meanings, though. And I think also there might be a moment where the industry isn't perhaps as interested in the pop diva as it used to be. Although, you know, given Celine Dion's recent performance at the Olympics, perhaps it's never, you know, the pop diva's never going to go away fully. But we'll see.
Yeah, and we'd have to hope for that, wouldn't we, on Adele? It does seem from what she said that because of the way her albums lay her life bare, it's a time where she wants privacy. And that's what puts these barriers around her music, because it does expose her.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the music industry appears to be following social media trends, you know, TikTok, for example. And I think pop stars should, you know, at the moment, it's that very much about the accessibility, the relatability.
creating that kind of realignment of values towards authenticity over that kind of mystique and being removed from your audience. So, yeah, I think Adele's make an interesting decision doing that at the moment. But then again,